Excellent presentation. Thank you. Okay, next we're going to have a public communication. Is there anyone signed up to address the board?
Nope.
Okay, no communication. All right, now we have an update of the Citywide Advisory Board.
How was that?
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Don't sit in my nice chair. We have to
sit in my chair. Oh, yeah. This one I asked for. This one's your office.
Okay.
Yes. It's a little bit more safer for me. Okay. For right now.
I respect that. Sorry.
So first of all, good morning. I have this on because it's required by my doctor to carry it all everywhere I go from now on. So don't panic. I'm good. Somebody told me this was my dog check. Or my princess in case you got lost. But it's not. But anyway, it's a pleasure again. This is a beautiful room. Kind of walked around. It's really pretty. Citywide Board meeting minutes for Haka, July 15, 2025 at 10:35 a.m. I, Lupe Garcia, Citywide Board President, call the meeting to order at 10:33 a.m. Veronica Castillo Perez, Citywide Board President, read the minutes for the last Citywide Board meeting. Alice Madrid, President of Gaston, provided treasury report. Citywide balance was $3,200. Presentation. Michael Ross, Vice President of PEMI, congratulations to Santa Rita for receiving a 98 score on inspection. We would like to thank residents for keeping their homes and communities clean and safe. Rand Cafe's luncheon is passwordless. Login. For pets and assistant animals on property, friendly reminder to please pick up your pet. Care for your animals and keep them on a leash. Awesome Pathways updates. Leilani Diego, Senior Director of Community Development. Welcome resident council leaders to the new Microsoft Teams virtual platform. The Microsoft is preferred software of HACA. Friendly reminder that there are no citywide advisory board meetings or resident council meetings in August. Our next citywide board meeting is on Tuesday, September the 9th. Adam McGreen, Youth Education and FSS. The 25th Annual HACA Resident Scholarship Ceremony is on July 25th at UT Elementary at 11 a.m. $76,000 worth of scholarships will be awarded to 40 HACA residents. Janice Spinoza, Workforce Development and Digital Inclusion Manager at HACA Job Fair, is scheduled for July 23rd. At Meadowbrook from 10 to noon, we encourage residents to attend to learn about job and educational opportunities and to connect with employers. For Amelie, Bringing Health Home Manager, Diabetes, classes scheduled at BTW, Booker T. Washington, and Manchaca Village classes will also resume at Gaston Place in August. Meeting adjourned, Sandy Jones, Vice President of Gaston, made a motion to adjourn the meeting. Carmen Rojas, Vice President of Santa Rita. Second meeting adjourned at 11:25.
Okay. Are there any questions regarding the minutes? No questions? Well, thank you very much, as always. And I just have one thing to say is that our relocation team is great. We're 100% on the cafe. All the El Cabrillo letters were passed out, and all the signatures letters that have to be returned at 100%. And so everything's going smoothly. Every residents are ready. We're ready.
We are too.
I'm ready.
And commissioners, you all know, so Lupe, in addition to being head of Citywide, heads up the Santa Rita Resident Council.
That's right.
And so the resident relocation for the redevelopment of Santa Rita starts really right after Labor Day, and we will have that property vacated by, we hope, by Christmas. So a lot of hard stuff coming for the residents there, to hold community together, and thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you. I enjoyed, and thank you all for the support. That it is panicking for the very beginning, but now it's kind of like, okay, we're just ready.
Okay. Are residents excited?
Yeah, they're excited. They're really excited. I mean, I'm excited. I'm sad and excited. Mixed emotions.
Hmm.
But, you know, like I always said, Santa Rita's my place, it's my home. But Yeah, we're all excited. We're always wondering where we're going to be. And right now I'm just looking for a place to hold IMOS meetings and continue with my events with the community.
We could definitely move them to Chalmers or to here. And we'll find a place for it. And I haven't had a chance to call yet, but I don't know if you heard about next week.
Mm-hmm.
So good. I should let the commissioners know too. So the new HUD regional administrator from Fort Worth, Ashley Quinones, is going to actually be in Austin. And so she'll be here on Wednesday, next Wednesday, if it's not confirmed. She's going to spend the morning with us and then the afternoon with the city. And so we're going to take her on our usual tour of Chalmers and Santa Rita and Rosewood. But when we end up at Santa Rita, and we're going to brief her at Chalmers on all of our RAD portfolio,
mm-hmm.
redevelopment work and other things. But when we get to Santa Rita, we've invited her at noon because she's going to have lunch. And who better to have lunch with than the IMOM? And so we're going to have lunch there and give her a briefing on what IMOM does and also about the relocation work there. So thanks for your help there. And commissioners, you all would be very welcome. I think, Mary, you're on tap to perhaps be there as well, but we'd love for all of you if you're available.
For the luncheon.
For the luncheon, or for any part of it. I'll update you later in today's session.
Okay.
And what the supportive events is.
Question? So it sounded like that all of them, the relocation will start right after Labor Day.
Okay.
And so how many are there that need to be relocated, and where all are they going? Do you have locations for them yet?
There's about close to maybe 90 residents, and we're having the 25th. And the 26th is we're having the open wait list, and everybody will come in, and they will input the properties of where they want to go.
Yes. So, commissioners, we are holding a waiting list opening for a number of properties, and our Santa Rita residents will be given top priority on all of those waitlist openings. So we have a number of properties within our portfolio that we will have available as vacancies do come up on the at the property. So we are also anticipating that a number of the residents will be able to go to Rosewood Court as the units are released, hopefully by before the end of this calendar year. Michael, is there anything else that you wanted to
say? Yeah, with what they had mentioned, there are 90 families currently still living at San. So there are 7 units that are already moved out through natural attrition and move-out process that we chose not to fill if we waited for this. And the goal is to get all 90 of them moved out by the end of the year to one of the properties.
Are there opportunities? So properties that they're moving to, are they all our former public housing properties, or are some of them in AAHC's portfolio?
All of them are in our Pathway to Asset Management former public housing portfolio.
Okay. Our RAD portfolio.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Lupe, thank you again for the presentation and report. And again, thank you for the reassurance. Remember, that's become one of your new responsibilities.
I enjoyed it. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Commissioner? Could I do a quick introduction before we go to the room? Hey, David, come on up real quick. Sorry, check on this. David Gates is a national leader in our, come on up to the mic. And I'd love for the commissioners, I'd love for you to know him. David and I have worked together for probably a decade at National NARO and a variety of different things. Come on up, see. You can introduce Tony. David heads up a housing authority in Arkansas, which actually is a conglomeration of 10, 12, 13 housing. And doing some really innovative things. It's to the east of Little Rock, isn't it?
Just north, northeast, yeah.
Okay. Introduce yourself to what you do, and most of the commissioners have been very active in NARO, so they just give a quick introduction and introduce Tony as well.
Yes, absolutely. I'm David Gates, like Mike said, Executive Director of Lone Oak County Housing Authority Natural State Housing Group is what we've renamed it now. I've got with me Tony Landecker. He's our new Director of Development, came from the HUD side, so he has now joined our team. We, as Mike mentioned, are close friends in the industry, and we were down here presenting at the THA conference, and I said, hey, we're already down here. Any chance we can collaborate a little bit and share ideas and swap ideas? It's realistically, it's going to be more me listening to y'all's ideas and stuff. And so we really just want to be a fly on the wall and just watch and learn and listen. And I mean, we definitely appreciate the invitation to come and so excited to see everything that y'all are doing.
Well, welcome.
Thank you all so much.
And Tony, you used to head up the HUD office in Arkansas, right?
Yeah, so I would be the equivalent of David Fuller for you all from the state of Arkansas. So we've heard rumblings of Mr. Gerber for a long time, so you got the...
Rumbling?
Real, you got a real superstar working for you.
Cool. Really? We didn't have it.
Well, glad to have you. And thanks for your HUD service. I worked with us for a couple of years, and you know, we lost Dave Fuller. Tony's, you know, moved now to, you know, to the agency, so he's still in the industry. But, you know, a lot of talent's been lost at heart. And it's a hard time that federal agency is having a moment. And industry, folks who are, you know, those who run housing authorities are going to step up and innovate in some different ways. And anyway.
Thank you all very much.
Before they leave, are there any questions that the commissioners would like to ask of them? Okay, well, welcome, and we enjoy your presence.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, the next item on the agenda is the consent item for approval of the minutes of the board meeting held on July 10th, 2025. I will entertain a motion for approval. Mary, first.
Second.
Second. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are approved. And now we are going to... There's something different of this meeting. We have several presentations, informational items, and the first on the agenda is the Boys and Girls Club presentation, and who will be presenting for us?
Let the whole team come up. Mr. Art here. All the kids love Mr. Art.
You know what? We'll stand. Y'all sit. Yeah.
Come on up.
Yeah, we all
You're supposed to say something like, y'all come on down, but I guess you just
got the presence.
You run over, right?
Yeah, of course. Just want to do a quick introduction, and we got the correct PowerPoint presentation. So just for a quick sort of background with the Boys and Girls Club, we've been in partnership with them since, 2008. They are in three of our Hawker properties. They serve after school clubs at Meadowbrook, Booker T. Washington, and Chalmers. And we are, you know, striving for increasing our 250 to almost 400 duplicated children that we're serving for the after school programs. And they just finished out summer. They had the back school programs. And just wanted to give them an opportunity to speak about their outcomes and what we're looking forward to for the next year. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club, Ms. Danae Campbell.
All right. Thank you, Leilani. And I'm taking a big back seat because y'all really want to hear from them. But I do want to first say again, Michael, and of course, Commissioners, thank you so much for your continued support and continued collaboration and being able to serve young people to our greatest ability directly within the community. We value and view our partnership with HACA as one of our highest priorities in the organization, and it is, it's been some tremendous success in my time, so I'm nearing 2 years here with the organization, and y'all were my first welcome. So this was the first group that I had the opportunity to come and speak with. We had a celebratory moment together, and so it is exciting to see how we continue to grow with one another and the things that grow from it. So our team today will talk a little bit about some of the success we've had over this last school year. And, of course, as Leilani said, we are gearing up for this school year, and I'll round this out with a couple of key updates about the organization. So I'll hand it over to Art.
All right. How's it going, everybody? So my name is Art Castillo, and I am the Director of Club Operations for the Boys and Girls Club here at our home club campus, but also our three HACA locations, which is Meadowbrook, BCW, and Chalmers. our impact. Boys and Girls Club is committed to provide a high-quality out-of-school time programming to our Haka youth at Meadowbrook, BCW, and Chalmers. Our goal is to provide ongoing support to approximately 300 youth at all the Hakas. We will serve three Haka communities with on-site programming offering 36 weeks of during the school, offering 36 weeks during the school year, 9 during the summer, with service offered to youth Monday through Friday with 4 hours per day during the school year and 7 hours per day during the summer.
Yes, please. Sorry. I'll give you a thumbs up.
After collecting data, we had over 318 Haka Club members that participated in academic success programming in the 24-25 school year. 95% of those Haka Club members in grades 5 through 12 are expected to graduate high school with a BGCAA promotional rate of 98.9%. Now, looking into the data, this is one of our biggest years, is that each one of our clubs had over 100 kids registered for the club. Breaking it down by each club, looking at BCW, we had 105 kids that registered for the club. For the school year, we had 30 that came each and every day. And for the summertime, we had about 19 that came every day. Chalmers, we had 102 registered for the club. 40 came for the school year, each and every day. For the summer, we had about 47. Meadowbrook was the highest, but we had 145 registered for the club. 30 came every day during the 31 came every day for the school year, and 30 came for the summer, each and every day. Breaking it down to the ethnicities. So, majority of the ethnicities that we provide is the pretty much the Hispanic and African American community. We had 42% of our kids are Hispanic, 37 are African American, 5% are white. And for the other races, we had about 16%. Now, jumping into the ages of the breakdown. At all three of the clubs, we serve pretty much five that were five and under. Majority of the kids that we do serve are ages 6 to 10. We had about 187 of those. Ages 11 to 13, we had 84. And ages 14 to 18, we had about 42. BGCAA's core programming consists of four focus areas: academic success, workforce development, healthy lifestyles, and character and leadership. Here are some of the programs that we provided for academic success. Power Hour. Here's where we pretty much gave the kids about 1 hour of homework time each and every day. Our Reading Club. This is where we're able to provide books and guided reading to help our kids with reading skills. And we also wanted to help them with their spelling, so we had majority of our kids participate in our summer annual spelling bee. Character and Leadership is our Torch Club program. This program helps our kids learn about, become better leaders, and also helps work with service learning projects, helps them do service learning projects. This is our first year that we provided a program called our Think, Learn, and Create program, pretty much to help our kids do research on social justice and advocacy issues within our community. Healthy Lifestyles. This is one of our biggest programs where we have the kids participate in sports and rec. We did a lot of games and teamwork building activities. We also had our kids help with mental health. We gave them mental health and coping strategies. Now, jumping into our workforce development, our career exposure. We took the kids and we took them on a field trip to go to one of our ACC, to go to ACC campus, which is the ACC Highland campus. And they went to a place called the Megat Center where they were able to do STEM projects with teachers and students. Some of the other programs that we provide for workforce development was coding, robotics, and engineering. And here's some of our community enrichment. These are some of the events and some of the things that we help provide our kids and families within the community. We had our annual back-to-school bash. This is where we hosted this at our home club campus, where we had kids, invited our kids and families to come to home club to grab backpacks and school supplies that they needed for back-to-school. Lights On After School is pretty much hosted in October, where we're able to showcase the things that we do at our clubs. So pretty much it's a showcase day. Taco team night. This is where we're able to shut the club down, you know, one Friday a month where we're able to shut the club down for all the elementary students and invite our teams to come to one of our clubs and have the teams pretty much have the club to themselves. Then we also provide an ongoing support for our school supplies. If there's a kid that needed a backpack in the middle of the year, we're able to provide backpacks, school supplies, and that for the rest of the year. Next is our monthly Hat Creek Hamburger Day. So the famous food chain Hat Creek Hamburgers were able to come to our facilities and provide burgers to our kids and families. Family engagement support. Here we're able to provide financial resources to help some of our families with rent, groceries, utilities, and etc. And then if needed, we're able to provide mental health referrals and guidances. For additional community support, this one is my favorite. This is where for a majority of our high school members, we were able to promote the free tuition ACC program, but more importantly, the HACA scholarship program, where they were able to get a scholarship. Jumping into our summer programming, we were able to provide 9 weeks of summer programming that began in June, which is on June 2nd through August 1st. They had weekly themes that included STEM, arts, sports, and health and wellness. The program was Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5:30. And one of the biggest highlights was that we were able to bring our kids to our home club facility to participate in a football clinic that was hosted by Jamal Charles. So we were able to meet and play with Jamal Charles himself. Welcome. Next is we wanted to provide something for our smaller kids. So we developed a T-ball tournament where we had our kids participate in pretty much learning how to play T-ball, and it was a great success. Next is we partnered with Austin FC and an organization called 4ATX and had some of our members participate in a soccer clinic. And last is our third annual spelling bee that we provide every summer to help our kids with their spelling, and that was hosted at the Austin Public Library.
Two questions on the mental health referrals. Are you referring to family members, or are you referring to kids, and is it for mental care? Or what is,
you know? I think it's for family members, for them.
Oh, where the referrals are for the mental health services.
Is our local soccer team, I see MLS Soccer Clinic, does our local soccer team get involved with you all?
Yes, ma'am.
Is that them?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Often I see.
Major League Soccer.
Major League Soccer.
And their name is, I know they're green.
Austin FC.
Austin Football Club.
Thank you. Okay.
Do they get to play at the stadium?
No, they come and bring they'll partner with 4ATX, find like a field, and then we'll participate depending on where the field is at. I have to go.
Hello, I'm Melissa Ibarra. I'm the club director at Chalmers. One of our highlights has been the grand opening ceremony. And at Chalmers, it has been through a few transitions, such as reconstruction, relocating to a different building. And we had the opportunity to bring some of our members to be a part of this, about to be in the grand opening ceremony. We had four girls attend, and then Maven, who has been at Chalmers for several years since he was little, and now he's actually a senior, he was able to give a speech, his experience at Chalmers, and it was a great experience for himself as well, and he also got to cut the ribbon with Kirk Watson. Another highlight has been team night. So we hosted a team night. We got all HACA members, Meadowbrook, Chalmers, NBTW to come to Chalmers and just kind of unite, bond.
Did you provide transportation for
them? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a great time to all get to know each other. We hosted several activities such as arts and crafts, game room, a basketball tournament, and then a Nerf gun battle, which was really fun. And then also provided some delicious snacks and drinks for them.
I'm Sydney. I oversee both Booker T and Meadowbrook, so this is our little highlight for Booker T. I know Art touched on a few of our field trips that we went on, just kind of wanted to talk a little more about them. Most of them are based off of our workforce development program, so we went to the Thinkery Children's Museum. Before that, we were challenged our kids to create pretty much an invention of something that's challenging their community. So a lot of our kids did, like, sad to say, like, pooper scoopers and stuff to pick up trash or other things, like stopping the rain and putting it in a gutter. So they were tasked to do that. They then brought their project to the Thinkery. And so when we went on our field trip, it was, like, super awesome to see their kids' projects there. So that was one of our first field trips of the year. We also did go to the Make It Center, which Art talked about. That was mostly for our middle school and high school students. So that was super fun. We took them in the summer, and they honestly loved it. I was a little skeptical about them just walking around ACC, but just having Chalmers and Meadowbrook and BCW all there, they really enjoyed it. The Highland campus.
Have you gone to the EC campus at all with Booker T?
Right next door to Booker T. I have not taken them there. I know with their schools over there, Oak Springs and Keeling, they tend to take them there a lot, but I thought it was pretty cool for us to take them to the other campus.
It's a good opportunity for them to learn about the health sciences programs, many of which weren't around when I was there. So it's a good experience for that. And I would also suggest that if there's some way of involving the parents, because the parents really don't know what fields are available for their children and for themselves. And so giving them that opportunity to the programs that require less than 4 years of college was excellent.
Oh, no, I definitely agree. One of those pictures at the bottom, they were in their health science lab, so they got to touch and play with some of the equipment, which they thought was super cool. They got to see, like, one of their massive freezers where they keep a bunch of, like, medicine that they're developing over there. So it was a really cool experience. Not only for me, but for the kids, I pray. Our next thing, along with the field trips, we did have some... Oh, sorry. Go back. We had fun field trips. They're not all centered around our academic success. We chose to do some recognition field trips. We took them to the movies. We took them bowling. We took them to the arcade. And that was mostly for our kids who attended 25 days or more during the summer. Summer is hard, summer is long, and the kids who showed up each and every day, we were just like, let's go. We're going to go have fun and do this. Also, our sports leagues, Art touched on that. It's mainly for our third through fifth graders, and it's soccer, flag football, and basketball. He did touch on the T-ball, so it was super awesome to see our little babies get to be on a team, because every single year, without a fail, am I old enough to play, Miss Sydney? No. But this year, they did. So the T-ball was awesome. I wish I had some pictures because those helmets on our little 5 and 6-year-olds were just a joy to see. And this is some highlights from Meadowbrook. As I said, I oversee both Meadowbrook and BCW. The highlight for this year was our Junior Youth of the Year program. So this program is for middle schoolers, and they're pretty much challenged to write about their club experience. They're going to give a speech. They're going to answer questions. So this year I had two from Meadowbrook, Atal and Yuli, and they've been a part of our club for, I've known them for 7 years. So seeing them start off kindergarten and come to this program was just, it was a highlight of my year, honestly. So they both competed. Atal won first place. He got $500. I get teary-eyed thinking about Atal, just because, like I said, I met him when he was six. I met him when he was not confident in his English, and to see him give a speech in front of, how many people would you say? Hundreds of people. I mean, I was crying that whole time. Mark was there, he saw me.
His
first speech was about just his club experience. So he touched on how he came to clubs, he didn't know English, he didn't have friends, and just the staff that made him feel so comfortable. So he's attended since he's been 6 years old, and now he's 13. So that's what his speech is about, and we loved it. He won, and it was very deserved. Yuli, our other candidate, she got third place, and we're still so proud of her. That was our Junior Youth of the Year program. And along with that, Art mentioned our Torch Club, which is a middle school program, which kids pick a social justice issue, and they work on a service project for that. So Atal was our president of our Torch Club, and him and a few of our other members decided to, on their project was to prevent gun violence in the community. So they worked with not only our staff, but City Council member Jose Velasquez to discuss gun violence and the impact. And with that, they made a PowerPoint, they made posters, and they were ultimately selected to go to Washington, D.C. and present their project. So I had three of my club members fly from Austin to Washington, D.C., and I've never been more proud.
Oh, yes, sir. Can we pause on that one for the same? So it was wonderful that he won, you know, whether it's you. But one of the things that these kids were raising also was the issue of, you know, not feeling as safe as we might wish they were feeling at Meadowbrook. And Meadowbrook is a property that Captainville coaches down. It's a tough neighborhood along the railroad track. We've done some things. But when we talk about the funding the police, or cuts the police, you know, the places where we've seen, you know, things start to spark up have been at places like Meadowbrook.
Yeah.
I find that I had an opportunity to talk to you today just before this meeting, and I know others on our teams are talking. But make sure that kids feel safe at all the clubs. I think we're in a moment right now at Meadowbrook, and I think we want to make sure we do what we can coming for you to really make them feel safer. So we'll try to, I'd like to really work with all of you on that as well.
I think
just saying
that, you know, that's, you know,
we didn't have the opportunity to add it into the report that we shared, but we will follow up with you all once we get the data. We expect it here in the next week or so that shows directly from each club that sense of safetiness. And it looks at both physical and also social and emotional. I will also just share, we are just grateful for the openness that we continue to receive at HACA, in that we do our annual safety assessment of all of our clubs, but having an external person come out, be able to take a look at each location and provide those that feedback and report, and then working on efforts to improve. We value that. We know that you all value that. So certainly would welcome. It's something that I know Art and I have talked about outside of everything that we're doing. Just a really, I think, time to collaborate on what's going on in the community. It's as painful as it is for y'all, for us as well, especially when it impacts young people. And so we're very interested in talking to y'all about what can we do more, how can we be more focused in that space. And I know there's other, you know, partners in this room that we probably should bring in that conversation. So definitely ready and open for that.
That's great. And we're looking forward to it in the fall. We're going to do a meeting with our resident council leaders, safety leaders, you know, a big team. So we'll look at that here a little bit more through the fall, but it's very top of mind.
Yeah. I do want to share, and I don't know how we do this or when we find the space to do that, and what Sydney talked about and the young people and their advocacy work. As y'all know how hard that is for us as adults, we're talking about teens. Really getting together, spending some time researching, understanding, and then voicing, their concerns, voicing their thoughts on how we can improve. It is a big deal about the work that happened out of the kids at Meadowbrook, and then to be selected to go to D.C. When they went to D.C., they were with hundreds of kids from across the country within Boys and Girls Club for our Youth Days of Advocacy. They were walking those halls. It was also at the same time, as we all know, around these federal funding freezes on programs and things. So not only were they talking about, hey, what's happening in my community, they were talking about this is happening in my community and this is why we need a resource in our community. We saw, and we like to give it to the kids, we saw that happen the next week on some funding that we were waiting on. It was lifted, right? So just the power of young people, I think it would be amazing for this group to hear directly from the kids. And so however we can facilitate that happening, because they did a lot of hard work and want to continue that.
We love to have them.
Yeah.
Maybe we can figure out a way to, you know, maybe invite a couple of the commissioners, maybe you and I could sponsor an ice cream party.
Absolutely.
Out at Meadowbrook where the kids are, and that way.
Absolutely.
And do it there. And that way they get a little bit, you know, imposing that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very proud of them.
If you had your brothers ponder like one or two specific needs that you have at this present time that we could address?
Well, I think it's a great question. There are a lot of things, I'm sure Mike knows this, that keeps us up at nighttime about the work we're doing. But I think it's the space that we just left from. I think time to sit down and let's strategize on how to really make some deep impact in the work around violence within the community, and particularly that's directly impacting young people, and in ways we can be, you know, proactive. If there's ways that we can be more engaging with some of the young people and some of our older young people, I think spending some time and then figuring out resources to make that happen would be really important. I would say is one. Two, I mean, honestly, it is engagement. What we see, our young people thrive off of seeing committed, dedicated adults leaning in to visit with them, see them, hear from them. And so, you know, I would just share, you know, opportunities to get more people engaged, you know, working with our kids. That's, you know, we always welcome that.
And what about the parents? I asked this question because when I was at ACC in Provo, I ran the Summer Youth Academy. And then I ended up doing a summer parent academy because it was important for the parents to understand the opportunities available for their kids and for themselves, as well as understanding that all these resources are there, many of which they didn't know about. One example, of course, now is ACC free tuition, but even prior to that, there are all these opportunities, and if the parents don't know, then they can't encourage the kids, as well as our being there to help encourage them. Mm-hmm. But we need to make sure that they're involved as well, so they don't say things like, if my kid goes to college, but when my kid goes to college. We've got to make that transition.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. One of the things that I think the club does really well is, one, is contact with families and parents. I think we build strong relationships that create that sense of belonging for parents to be able to, you know, talk with us, engage on their child with us, and there's certainly a lot more work we can do, but I think it takes a collaborative space of, you know, being able to lean in and figure out what are those things that we can continue to share with our parents, engage with them, but then move along the line to where you're going of, you know, from education to us actually empowerment within the community. And so we know that's all of us group to be able to do that. And I think opportunities that y'all as a body see and other partners that you see would benefit from that, we are open. We will gladly facilitate, have the time, the spaces to be able to do that. We can pull our families and parents in to be able to do that. There's been some some really great work. I think the team does a great job, like even on the work with the advocacy, where they're talking to the families about what their child is doing. And in some spaces, that's slower movement, and then some is fast as our parents get engaged. You know, Cindy shared with us about Atal. I think, you know, I've had the opportunity, you know, to meet with Atal's family upon him winning, and I think just the light bulb that opened to say, we're surrounding your child in this way, allows for her to do a lot more when it comes to anything else I want to connect you to now. And so the more that we do that, I think the easier that door opens.
Do you guys have a Boys and Girls Parents Club?
No.
It's a
great idea. One of the things that we're growing in, it's actually a really good idea. So one of the ways that we're growing this year is to move, and this is organization-wide, we're moving into now our youth council. But just as important for us as a parent council or a parent body to help support us. You know, the team, again, they do a great job. We are communicating out. I think it's that first level of engagement. It's how do we move it to those next phases of, okay, here's the education opportunities. And it's here and there, but consistently, I think, you know, working with our friends at CIS, I mean, I think there's just a lot of opportunity for us to, you know, connect those dots in a very collaborative way. But I like the name of Parent Club.
For a small fee of
it. Yeah.
I think, yeah, what you know, the moms that are doing, you know, active work through the iMom program that Lupe is experiencing, you know, under some kind of a curriculum with Boys and Girls Club should really be,
yeah,
you know, just parental support. I mean, you know, I have two wonderful girls, they would say, you know, it's a joy to bring them up. But there were just days when getting together with other dads, other parents, and they would say, I'm ready to kids. It was really helpful. And it gave you perspective. It gave you something to take along with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that is an area we certainly want to do better and better, and that is not just for some, right? I think that's the space of for some, like, we do that really well and engage in some spaces, but how do we create a system that's for all of our parents? Yeah.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get started on different properties? Let's say Santa Rita has a lot of children. How, when we start a Boys and Girls Club over there, or how does that
We happen? Are ready to talk. just as easy as that, I think.
Santa Rita.
Yeah, I think that is the space. First level, Mike and I think, you know, connecting and kind of crafting out where we want to go, where we want to be, what we want to do from that end. For an art, I hope I didn't cut the presentation short. Did you have anything else that you want to share with us?
I also want to say, like, I think one of the best things that the team does is that we want to be the face of just, like, Ad Haka. So any kind of community events that happen on property, we want to go ahead and be there and participate as much as possible. But also the team does a great job of participating in the resident council meetings. So go ahead and share stories, maybe share some of those impact stories and some of the things that we do at club. And I have to commend to my team. But, yeah.
I wanted to add about the picture. Remember, we had a Rosewood Boys and Girls Club once upon a time, and we had to shift because of the construction and redevelopment. So I think it's always been the mission to expand. That we've been having those talks, and so we're definitely going to explore that opportunity. But especially with the new spaces, that we Hawking has the opportunity to design it the way that we needed for our resident services. That before, as I got hired, we had to do with what we had. So there are opportunities for that. So thank you for the question. We'll definitely speak more to it.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a most interesting conversation, and let's say a beginning conversation, because I think it's something that we need to do on a regular basis and share information, share ideas. But, Mary, did you have
It has nothing to do with Boys and Girls Club, but a question has come up several times by other residents of Vasquez. Why is there a health and wellness class like at Santa Rita or other properties? Why is it only at Solomon?
So I think what we've tried to do is different thing about all our programs. So the reason the Boys and Girls Club at Chalmers is because it's a community school program at Santa Rita.
We had a Boys and Girls Club at BPW, but there's a few schools. So we tried to spread it out some. The thing that was really nice about St. Meadowbrook is that we have both a Boys and Girls Club and a community program. And both really complement each other well.
Yeah.
Community schools. So you're going to hear from CIS in just a moment, but they do, similar but slightly, different things to different degrees of depth, and also they really look at the kids to sort of meet those needs. We've tried to, it's really been an issue of the space that we have. We've had these really small rooms, so now that we're rebuilding, we have a lot more space to do more creative things. Just building in a really, first class, child care center at Santa Rita is really important. There's opportunities to do things with community schools and Santa Rita Boys and Girls Club there too. So let's keep that conversation going.
Okay. That's good.
We hope to make things so things are nearer to people. It's always better when it's on property, but we try to lose the idea of saying, generally our properties are north, east, and south. And to have these kind of hubs if we can, to try to get them there. But there are many transportation issues, and people sometimes don't go. Can I ask one last question about Boys and Girls Club, though? So when I look at the numbers, 145 signed up for Meadowbrook, but your daily census is 35 or 40, how do we get more kids going on a more consistent basis, daily? Or is that reflective of they have other activities and they're coming, they maybe come Monday and Thursday, but they don't come the other day? So on any given day, you're hitting 35 is the average. But are you concerned that there aren't kids who are not to come for, all things that you want to, kids and clubs are going to do better. So somewhere, how do you increase that attendance is that even an issue that's going to be considered?
I know that's something that we're definitely working on, but kind of what you said is there's other things out there that are kind of pulling them in.
Yeah.
A lot of them are in sports, a lot of them are in other things, and I think that's the only thing that really holds them back.
And are the clubs in no phone zone? Like the schools? No.
Not necessarily in where we're in freestanding, such as within Mahaka. Yeah, so we're aligned at the school.
We can try it.
Yeah. I know we're wrapping up, but just to again share our gratitude for continued partnership with HACA and just how it continues to grow. I think one of the things Art started with when he talked about the numbers, his excitement about the level of growth that we've already been able to see. Mike, it is something we're looking at in terms of increasing that frequency of attendance. We are glad to see that duplication of over 100 at each of the clubs. The first thing, I think, access matters, right? And I think that's, what y'all are sharing, right? In terms of having spaces and whatnot, access matters. So when you do need it, you have it. And then let's make sure that we are enticing them to say, you can be here every day because there's something here for you every day. And so our team has done a great job with that. Hopefully you see with the report infusing new programs, like that advocacy program, I think, was one that was very specific to our Meadowbrook area that I think when we saw the summer numbers was really nice to see the jump in that. So we're excited. We're still working to do better, get better, and just, ask for the continued, partnership and collaboration and lean in so we can figure it out together.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming today, and I look forward to another conversation very soon. And I really appreciate the cooperation and the partnership that we're developing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
I remember seeing Art playing with the kids in my back. And I was at the old Chalmers. I don't know who's having more fun.
Always Mr. Art.
So I think CIS is next up.
Thank you. Hey, thank you for having us.
CIS is our next presenter.
So now we're going to transition to communities and schools, and we have here Ms. Sharon Vigues, who is the CEO of Communities and Schools, and we also have one of our researchers joining us via Zoom because she is from out of town, so I'll go ahead and hand it over to Sharon.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Just get started? Okay. So today, I've invited our third-party evaluator to share academic-focused data about our HACA students. As a reminder, last time we presented about the activities that we do, about our financial assistance, and you all wanted to hear a little bit more about academics because you all received an enhanced CIS program where we work with students in their schools Monday through Friday, but then additionally, we also work with them at their housing authority site, and we're working with families there, and so students get a lot of CIS services throughout the entire day, specifically those that are HACA residents. Other schools don't get that. Other programs don't get that. So we really call this our CIS enhanced model.
Does that mean the CIS model involves those schools where the HACA students are attending?
Correct. So
what four?
We are at Becker, Dawson, Eastside, Keeling, Lively, Martin, Oak Springs, Travis Early College High School, Zavala in Woolridge.
But in essence, if I remember, there's one high school, which is Travis, and three middle schools and four elementary. Is
that correct? We have also Eastside.
Also Eastside Early College High School.
The high school. Yeah, so we might have started that way, but what we want to do is we want to follow students where they go. And because often AISD is a transfer portal, if one of our HACA students is at an elementary or at a high school, we still serve them, and they receive services throughout.
I think one of the things that we need a little bit of clarification about is what are the components of your model for method management, case management?
Yeah, let's go ahead and let's get started.
Yes. And then we get into the academics. Because I think last time we talked about this, we talked about you're going into the homes and making home visits, etc. I'm assuming that that's one of the components, but what are the other components, and what are you doing for housing authority students above and beyond the case management for the rest of those students in the school?
Great. Yeah, so let me go ahead and let's get started. I think Heather is going to share her screen. Heather, that's not the one. It doesn't have the need and trauma. I'm sorry.
Right. I'm sorry. Hold on 1 second. We got a couple of versions going. Yes, here we go. Okay.
Great. But before I share with you all about our services, I really want you to understand why CIS is even created. I think that you have to start with the why before we talk about the how and the what we do. So next. So when we talk about the need for communities and school services, these numbers are not just statistics. They really live in the reality of many of our students here in Central Texas. So one in every student lives in poverty. One in five students have been sexually molested. One in four was beaten by a parent to the point of leaving a mark behind. One in three couples in America engage in physical violence. One-fourth of Americans had an alcoholic parent, and one-eighth Americans witnessed their mother being beaten. So when we're talking about why CIS exists, is because we have students that are really leading heavy lives. And we know that this causes trauma. So when we look at what trauma does to the brain and what it does to the body, and this is important because when I start telling you about our case management, it's important to understand this. So when we think about why some students struggle in school, it's not always about motivation or ability. It's not about reading level or math level, but many times it's about trauma and what they're living through before they even set foot in a classroom. Trauma changes how the brain processes information, so instead of being in learning mode, students get stuck in survival mode. A child who is consistently on alert, scanning for danger at home or in their community, has little capacity left for spelling tests or math problems. This shows up as a student who can't remember instructions, can't focus long enough to complete work, or seems distracted. It's not a lack of intelligence, but it's that their brain is protecting them from threat that they perceive as real. When students are triggered, trauma can cause a flight or fight or freeze response. You know, sometimes you hear a teacher say, this child is not behaved well. And we focus on the behavior instead of the root cause of what is causing that. Well, this child can't focus on reading. Well, we don't focus on what is keeping that child from focusing. So emotions within the body, students that may complain of headaches, stomach aches, and appear restless, these aren't excuses, but they are physical manifestations of trauma. Next. This image that I'm going to share with you next, this image that I'm going to share with you is really important. On the left, you see a typical development brain. On the right, you see the brain of a child exposed to neglect, trauma, and abuse. Notice how much less activity is present. Trauma literally changes how the brain functions. For students in this state, their brain prioritizes survival, not learning. That's why some of our students struggle with attention, focus, and behavior. This is not a character flaw. They are biologically responding the way the brain and the body has to respond. But the good news here is that trauma is not an end of a story. The brain is resilient, and it can actually be rewired. With the right intervention, students can learn processing skills, developing coping strategies, and actually rewire their brain towards healing and growth.
Sharon, Bethel Bendicol has had a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for the last 250 weeks called The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
It documents this, and it is mind-altering.
It is.
Really about the impact of these stressors and traumas on people's lives.
Thank you. And if you all, CIS would love to gift it to you, because I think it shows the clearest imagery of why CIS is on campus and why our work at your HACA sites is so important. Next. So now that you know what our students are facing, let's talk about our model. So our model traditionally happens directly on campus. We place one CIS full-time staff on campus, and they carry a caseload. That full-time staff member never leaves campus. They're working with teachers. When a child is dysregulated, or when a child is saying that they want to commit suicide. You know, I was a teacher, a third grade teacher. He did not teach us how to handle that stuff. They taught us how to classroom manage, but not in that way. They taught us how to teach kids how to read, but not how to bring someone down from a crisis. So that is when CIS steps in, and then we case manage that entire family. We start off with meeting with the principal, making sure that we are helping the principal with their campus improvement plan, which every principal has to submit that to the Texas Education Agency. Then we work with the campus to identify students who are the highest need, and then they get on a caseload. For HACA sites, that's different, because what happens is that we place another staff member on a HACA site, and all they do is work with HACA students all day, every day. So even before a HACA student comes on campus, our staff has already been at their housing authority site, building relationships with the parents, reminding parents, hey, it's the first day of school. Hey, do you need a haircut? Hey, I see that we haven't seen you in the past week. What's going on? What supports do you need? So we really are merging school and home with relationships. So then we work with students, and every student gets what we call Tier 1 services. These Tier 1 services are available for the entire campus. That is eyeglasses. It is feminine hygiene items. One in four girls miss a school because they do not have the hygiene items that they need to attend. This is clothing closets. This is weekend backpack food. This might be a pep rally to remind people the importance of the star and how you can self-regulate. Then tier two services are where we have small groups, where we are working with students who have similar needs. So if the child is having heavy persistent stress, then what we would do is put them in a group with self-regulation, where we teach them to psycho-identify, oh, wait a minute, when I'm in classroom and I start feeling this way, remember that trauma? Then we can say, when you have that feeling, let us create a plan of what you can do. What we don't want you to do is scream. That might be okay at home, but let us teach you something different here. So then we give them tools and techniques so that they can self-regulate. Then we have tier three services where we're working with students one-on-one. One-on-one services are students who have anxiety, depression, have suicidal ideation, or have tried to commit suicide. And this is where our staff is working with them, and we're working with them and their families, and we are getting them out of crisis, helping them regulated, and making sure that they are safe. That would be the end of a CIS service. But you all get additional support. Our staff then go and drive to a housing authority site. And let me remind myself of which ones they are really quick. They are Booker T. Washington, Golden Oaks, Chalmers, Meadowbrook, and Santa Rita. And then we welcome those students who just left campus, and we are working with them doing out-of-school time programming, continuing to do self-regulation, because what we want them to learn is that these techniques to keep you safe don't just happen at the school. You can also take them home and let us work with you. At the same time, we do something called porch visits. At that time, we have volunteers, and we bring partners, and so we bring the UT science crew to talk to the students about science in college. We have a partnership with the Emma Barrientos Mexican American Cultural Center, where they actually do 3D printing and they learn real sculptural stuff. They also have academic time where we're helping them, but then they also have our continued case management time, where we are meeting with them, talking about self-regulation. We are also doing porch visits, walking with parents, saying, hey, Sharon was late to school 3 times this week. How can we help you? Okay, you need a ride? We can do that for you. Oh, wait, is it because you don't have clothing? Don't worry, we got you. Oh, and you need money for this? We're supporting you. So we're working with parents throughout to make sure that they are also receiving the tools, the skills that they need to be healthy for themselves, because you can't give something away that you don't own, and that they can be healthy for their children. So that's a little bit about our program. Can you click next?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, most of the time people say, well, tell me exactly what you do. Well, this is exactly what we do. If a child needs mental health, behavioral health services, here's a menu. If a child needs parent enrichment opportunities, these are the things that we do. If they need parent and family engagement, then this is what we do. We really are individualized, and we are able to provide a full scope of services because we're able to leverage resources from the community and partners. And for you all, it's special because it's not just on campus, but we're bringing that to the housing authority site as well. And then it doesn't end there for you all, because we do a little bit more. Then we actually do summer programming directly on school campuses, the ones that I mentioned, and we do 3 to 4 weeks of free programming, summer programming, on your housing site. And not only that, but our field trips and our summer activities aren't just for students, because we really center the family. We also have family field trips. So families are able to explore the city of Austin without having to pay for it through CIS. Whew, now I'm tired. Yeah, so we would go to UT for a Longhorn activity, and the parents come, and we provide transportation for them, and we're talking about what it looks like for students to be at a college and what it looks like for parents to support them. Then we have things like the glass bottom tours, boat tours. So we provide transportation to San Marcos, and parents are able to do that. Then we also rent out laser tags. And we have thousands of parents, families there. So it depends. We transition from educational to also, we want families to laugh together, because we also know that joy is a cure for trauma. And so we provide that as well.
So I think your plan is also
Because a lot of the stuff you're doing towards also the Compass to College.
Yes, work. We do a lot of Compass to College work. Yes, okay, yes, sorry.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you. Additionally, at all of your high schools, you're also getting Compass to College work through a higher education coach. This higher education coach works with 11th and 12th grade students, and we are helping them apply to colleges. We're helping them explore what they want to be, their score of theirs. And we're also looking at their grades. We're also looking at, hey, it looks like you're missing 2 credits. How can CIS help you pay for this, for you to get these credits, and how can we help you get them? We help them apply to colleges. We help them visit colleges. We help them write their essays. We take parents on 2 to 3 college visits alongside their children, and we help them get to college. And we have a story at the end of this presentation of a student who we actually just took all of her college dorm goodies that CIS gifted her because she will be starting at Texas State. She did win her HACA scholarship, and she also won a full ride scholarship to Texas State. And she has been with CIS since elementary and has been with us since graduation.
I'd like to just pursue that for a moment. In addition to beginning that activity at the high school level, it's, in my mind, more important to begin at the middle school level.
Yes, that is in
career exploration, both for the parents and the children. And secondly, making sure that they understand if they're going to be going to higher education, the type of curriculum they're going to have to follow in high school. So if we don't begin early enough, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, and so I will say that we actually start this process at the pre-K level, but HACA doesn't pay for it. That is just part of the work that CIS does with our programming. So as soon as a child is part of our program, they are crafting goals, and they are looking at, what do I want to be when I grow up? We are talking to them about grades, attendance, not just to them, but to their parents. We're also helping parents at the pre-K to second grade level really focus on reading. And so we have reading buddies that are accessible to all children. They come into the school, and they work with students who have needs weekly. Additionally, for pre-K to second, we partner with Literacy First. Any child who's not at reading level, then they get a referral to Literacy First. We do a lot of literacy nights. Then we transition at the middle school level, where we're focusing on math, and we're doing summer bridge programs, and we're talking to students more about exploration. They even take an assessment to explore their skills. So for us, that is just embedded in the culture of what CIS does at the pre-K level. I'm just sharing the Compass to College, which is part of your contract, but CIS does that from pre-K all the way to 12th grade. Okay, so let me turn it. I know you all wanted us to talk about academics. It's what we received, but I just want to share with you all that we are also held accountable to TEA. So we have to have TEA accountability standards for our work with students. And each year they review our data, and each year they review our students' accountability. If we do not meet students' accountability, then we are put on a performance improvement plan.
Now, is this done at the school level?
At the national, at the state level.
And that review takes place.
Yeah, so at the state level, there is a CIS office in TEA, and we have to submit all of our data, student grades, attendance, and then they have their own data and research department that evaluates schools and evaluates CIS as well. And in that process and that evaluation, they grade us on accountability. So I say that because we hold ourselves to the highest of standards, and we actually welcome that level of accountability. Additionally, every year we contract with a third-party evaluator to make sure that the work that we are doing is moving the needle for students in academic attendance and behavior in school. I will be honest, I do care about people feeling good in life, but for me, I want that to lead to kids being successful. And so if I can't show that connection to academics, then I start to worry. So I am going to hand it over to Heather Coulter, who is our third-party evaluator who works out of Colorado. And she digs into our data, and she tries to find what we're doing well, but most importantly, what we're not doing well so that we can fix it. And so she's going to dig into academics and attendance and how our program makes sure that we're moving the needle for students.
All right. Thank you, Sarah.
There's a question. Okay. There's a question. Hold on.
How many communities and school programs are there around the state?
Yeah, there's 27, but we're the best.
No. No, <okay.
laughs> no, there's 27 of us total.
Are you the biggest?
We are the second. We are tied with San Antonio. But we are the envy of national affiliates and state affiliates because of this partnership. They've come and studied it often because you'll see what Heather is going to present to you, what happens when we enhance services and bring that to their homes. And so I think that people are starting to see that this enhanced CIS is a good return on investment.
And is this the, I know that you presented the Harvard study last time. Is this partnership included in that Harvard study?
Yes. Your students are part of the Harvard study for 25 years. So your numbers were in there. Harvard won't pick out just only HACA students, but you all are part of that Harvard research that shows that CIS students, they followed them well into their employment age, and they found that CIS students were less likely to be incarcerated, less likely to be dependent on federal government assistance, and less likely to be unemployed, and that they earn $100,000 more compared to other students that did not have CIS, and additionally that these individuals are giving $9,000 back in tax returns into their community.
So the school, is participation in communities and schools part of, does AISD invite you all in, or is it individual schools that say, we want this program in a particular school?
It's at the district level. So we currently serve...
That's at the district
level. Yep, so we currently serve 9 school districts. And part of our contract with each school district is that we do outcomes-based performance measures as well for academic behavior and attendance.
And then the school district determines what schools within that district will have a program?
We work alongside of them. We actually have a needs matrix. We leverage a lot of extra funding to support the schools. The schools do not pay the full cost of CIS, and so we do not serve high wealth campuses. We usually are serving campuses that are known as Title I. That means that they have the highest rate of low socioeconomic and disadvantaged students.
Thank you.
Okay, Heather, I think you're
all right. Those questions are actually a great segue. I'll just introduce myself really briefly. I'm Heather Coulter. I've been working as a researcher and evaluator exclusively in the nonprofit sector and with youth nonprofits for about 18 years now. This is, I think, my fourth year being called upon to do CIS third-party evaluation. I not only look at HACA and programs like that, but actually agency-wide, and then we do different breakdowns for the different school districts and even campuses. And I'm going to say that it was a great segue to talk about how Smart Kids and HACA programming is an enhanced model, because every year I've come to look forward to looking at the Smart Kids data, because it really does show in the numbers that they are getting that extra enhanced service. So I just gave them a list of things that you all were especially interested in over and above the annual report that was shared, I believe, in the winter. We have another annual report coming up this year, and we do have new numbers for this year. So some of this is going to be kind of a preview from that. But most of all, we wanted to spend some time
digging in deeper to academics, mostly, as that was what was requested, that's a great concern. Along with some of the ways, as Sharon talked about, that GIS really supports students in a holistic way. And so we also have some data on how these other things around behavioral health and wellness and attendance play into academic achievement and make an important contribution there. So first, in the spirit of the introduction that Sharon gave, she asked me to share with you what we mean and how we measure student behavioral health and wellness needs. So this is actually dictated by CEA, that they have a set of behavioral health and wellness, what they call targeted need areas. So we have a norms-validated assessment that is given to all students at intake, mid-year, and exit, and we look at growth on those things. This slide shows the percent of HACA-served students who qualify for each of these need areas. As you can see, some of them are very high. So 71% of students had a above-threshold need in social skills. Persistent stress was the next really big one, with 67% showing a need, along with self-esteem and self-regulation. And then some of the lower needs are still very important, and they're assessed and addressed for students who need those things. And so persistent stress, for people who might not be clear on the definition of that, is needs related to feelings of worry, nervousness, and unease. And as Sharon mentioned, talking about trauma, that this can lead to avoidance behaviors and physical symptoms like headaches and stomach aches. So that's just kind of some broad context that I want to carry with while we're talking about academics and some of these other improvements and how they come about through GIS programming. So first of all, I believe you saw this in your 23-24 program report, but I just wanted to ground us in it again. As I mentioned, every year when I do the CIS third-party evaluation, we break apart different groups. What this shows us is that all CIS students have really great outcomes. The main things that they look at are the percent that stayed in school, that graduated or were promoted. Those are 99 and 99.9% across the board. And then improving in at least one of their individual need areas. So some students have more of an academic need. Some have an attendance need. A lot have a behavior need. And so when we look at that compared to, there are two groupings here. One, the blue numbers represent students who live on housing authority sites who do not attend the after-school programming, which last year was 287 students. And they had better outcomes than the general CIS numbers, with 88% improving one or more of their need areas. And then SMART Kids is what we're talking about, is the enhanced CIS model, where they're getting those extra hours of after-school support, those extra layers of opportunities and services at their home housing site. And of those,
I'm gonna walk in really quick, Heather. So I want to make clear that both HACA students and SMART Kids get enhanced models.
Yes.
They're just different. All CIS students do not get the same parent engagement, basic need support, home visits as your HACA students. So you all get almost a two enhancements from our CIS. And I also just want to say that we really wanted to bring you a comparison to a non-CIS student. But unfortunately, AISD's ECST is broken down, and they are having a lot of transitions right now, and so they're figuring that out. But let me just ground us in this number. Most importantly, remember when I started sharing with you all CIS students are selected because they have the highest needs on campus. So I'm going to say that. That means that when we're, and it's always hard to bring you all a comparison group, because a comparison group doesn't have as highest needs. They're usually wealthier. They are usually doing well with family. And so actually the most real comparison group, quasi, is other CIS students who are high needs as well. But this kind of jades things, because VCIS students are also getting services, because we serve the highest needs students. And so I just wanted to say that to you all, that this, we're really proud of these numbers, and you should be proud of your students, because traditionally HACA students are among the lowest socioeconomic students on campus. They are the ones who are seeing the most violence in the home, and they are the ones that have usually the highest rate of family conflict. Okay, we can go ahead and go to the next slide.
Sarah, I'm very glad you said that, because as a researcher, that has been a frustration, especially in the last couple of years, is not having that valid external non-served comparison group, and it's something that we're working on. So I'm very glad that you pointed that out. Okay, so moving on, as far as services and programming, as mentioned, we're talking about this as the enhanced CIS model. So this just shows you just how many more services and service hours the HACA students are getting compared to even AISD averages. And AISD actually averages slightly higher than agency-wide. So case management...
I'm so sorry. I just want to stop, because if you'll see, AISD is only getting 17.1 hours. Your students are getting 28.7 hours, and smart kids are getting 58.3 hours. And then if you look at how much we're engaging with families, much more differently at HACA sites and for smart kids students than for AISD students. This is super, super important. And if they're not small percentages, they're really large percentages of increase.
I have a question. When you say case managers, are these social workers? Are they educators? Are we comparing case managers to the AISD hours we're getting just from their in-classroom instruction, or is it on top of that?
It's completely on top of that. So most of our staff do have either social work background or psychology, it's usually social workers and that sort of level of background. This is hours that are different than what is happening in the classroom.
Exactly. Yes, thank you, Sharon, for pointing that out. These are very important. I also want to point out the access at the end of the parent and family engagement for smart kids. That is very likely actually an underestimate, because in the after-school time, not necessarily every parent interaction is being logged in our data system as a distinct family engagement event. It's more just part of their everyday. So it's actually likely an underestimate on family engagement with the smart kids participants. So now getting into what was asked for here primarily is, how does all of this look in terms of how students are doing academically? So to start off, looking at last year's academic improvement, again, similar, mirroring those findings of overall any targeted need improvement, what we saw was that smart kids especially had very, very high rates of academic improvement when they had an academic targeted need. A little bit on targeted needs. We assign a student an academic targeted need when they are below average in one or more of their course grades, and that actually depends on their grade level. So for earlier grades, the focus is on literacy, reading, and ELA. If they're behind or failing or below average in one of those course grades, then they get an academic target for academic improvement. Moving into the later grades, it's still on reading, but also really focused on math. They automatically get targeted need for academics with a math issue. So as you can see, again, similar to the general improvement numbers, smart kids 92% improved academically. The HACA case-managed students improved by at a rate of 88%, versus a little lower for the AISD averages. This year, those numbers were even higher. So 100% last year of all smart kids students improved in their academic targeted need area, an 8% increase from the previous year. Case-managed students, that went up to 92%, so a 4% improvement, compared to a more modest 2% improvement for all AISD students. So those are
When you say targeted need area, so if a kid has a deficiency in math, you're spending time focusing on that, and you get the deep dive, so you're only looking at that one.
Not necessarily. So yes, in a way, in terms of how they measure the data. So if the student's deficiency was in math and they improve their math score, that's when we count them as improved. But if they're deficient in more than one subject, then they need to improve on all of those subjects. So
Heather, but what he was asking is, when someone is targeted, then they receive that specific
service based on that target?
Right.
So the answer is yes. So when someone is targeted in math and they also have persistent stress, because the thing is you just can't target one thing. So just think about when you have high blood pressure. Well, you just can't target the high blood pressure. You have to target the blood. You have to target the stomach. All these things. So the same thing with the students. So we target math, making sure that they have potential math tutors, that we are doing math intervention. But also we want to focus on that persistent stress. So what is causing that persistent stress? Let's give that student some coping mechanisms. So we are providing school layer support, but when we are targeting academics, we're targeting academics. We're not giving them a behavioral, referral. Correct. So yes, Heather. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So this slide, as mentioned, is looking at students with those targeted needs. But I know that you're also interested in how all of the students served, the HACA students served, are doing academically as well. One more slide on targeted needs. So we were asked to break things down a little bit further by grade level and age level. So I did that here. The numbers for this sometimes weren't big enough to show you a graph by every grade level, but we'll get to that in a second for all students. But for targeted needs students, again, you can see here, it varied a little bit by level, but pretty much across the board, 100% of all SMART kids improved. There actually weren't any 6th or 8th grade SMART kids participants who had an academic need, and in a second I'm going to show you why that is. And all of these rates were higher rates of improvement versus the CIS averages for non-HACA students in the district. So now getting to, across the board, all 379, I think, students that live on Housing Authority sites that are served by CIS, we were asked to break this down by grade level, so that is what you can see here. And just general take home, you can see that in almost every single case by grade level, achievement levels for the vast majority of students are quite good. And especially, as you can see, for 4th through 6th graders, very few of these students were below a B average. Most of the averages were in the B-plus range, which is why they are not being specifically targeted with an academic need. Math grades tended to be even higher. And then when we lay over students, the non-HACA AISD students, again, just this theme that in almost all cases, the SMART Kids students have higher average grades than the comparisons of those that aren't attending the SMART Kids After School program and those that aren't served through the HACA model. So it's also important to look at what does change look like throughout the year? How do we measure improvement? And so these graphs show the average grades in reading and math by grading periods. So from at the end of the first grading period, their starting grade, to the second, third, and fourth. Something you might notice here is that there tends to be a dip in the middle. And that happens every year at every campus, at every level. I've reached out to the district to find out if that's just CIS students or if we can get comparison across the board. But it's something that we always see, and the explanation usually is that first grading period is more review of what they already knew, and then the second grading period is when they start to be assessed on new material and it becomes more rigorous and difficult. So what we really look for in grades improvement is how they do at the end of the year, especially compared to that second grading period and also somewhat to the first. And what we can see here is that the SMART Kids After School program participants so the very most improvement. They have the highest end-of-year grades and the most increase. They also have slightly higher grades to start the year, which is interesting. And we have some evidence that I'm going to get to in a couple of slides on why that might be. But so they have higher course grades to start the year. They have a smaller mid-year decline. So that drop into the second and third grading periods is smaller. And they have a larger rebound or a larger increase to finish the school year. So this is why we really see those higher rates of academic improvement for SMART Kids participants. I will note that the HACA case-managed non-SMART Kids participants still outperform and out-increase the non-HACA averages. So speaking to why maybe the Smart Kids students have higher grades to begin the year. It turns out that 80% last year and a similar percent the previous year of students who attend Smart Kids have been attending for multiple years. So what we were able to do was combine 3 years' data sets. And what we found was that students who were new to Smart Kids, it was their first year, had a bit more modest increases in academic achievement. Those that were served by CIS and in Smart Kids for their second year, up to 90% of them started to improve. And in their third or more years, 94.5% improved. So it's something that builds on itself. And it really speaks to how continuity of participation in the program yields lasting results for students. So this graph is a little different. This is all Smart Kids participant students, graphed by which year it was for them in the program. And what really stands out here is the first year in Smart Kids students started out pretty far behind. This is specifically in the average of all of their course grades. But then they began to catch up. And by the end of the year, they had made academic gains. They were almost at the level of those students that had been participating for multiple years. So I felt like that was really compelling evidence that the program is doing a lot for students, and it's helping them maintain those gains and not rebound again at the beginning of every school year.
And this graph is a clear example of closing the achievement gap. Because when we look at academic improvement, we're not just looking at where students are starting and ending, but at the rate at which they improve. Because what we want to see about closing the achievement gap is those students that statistically we know would do better are doing well. But then what we want to see is those students who statistically should not be doing better doing this. And so for us, this really talks about the enhanced model and how important it is not just to continue, but also to close that rate, that achievement gap. And so, Heather, I think I'm going to stop here for questions. And because I think we did academics a lot, and also I know that we need to wrap it up. But any questions for Heather about academics? And we do have more slides in regards to attendance and how we support kids staying in school and attending school, but we can send that PowerPoint to you all. I'll just pause here.
Well, you asked for data, Madam Chair. We gave you data. Can I say two quick things? One is the data is very impressive, and I think that we have seen at a informal level during the pandemic the impact that CIS made in really holding the glue together in an awful lot of our families and it's an awful lot of our kids. So, you know, I would say we're unabashedly high on, you know, the program that you've got. That said, this really helps to sort of shape up sort of from the board's perspective the accountability piece, and as we think, you know, it's a big contract. And so as we think about those pieces of it, I hope that this gives the board a little bit of additional confidence in the impact. The last thing I'll just say is that there's a part of this that's just, there's an intangible. You know, we can't be there for every conversation that happens on a porch. We can't be there for every, you know, opportunity to, you know, see a kid with a teacher and maybe saying, you know, hey, let's improve your math, but let's also, you know, let's figure out how we also work on self-regulation. I mean, it's just, you know, it doesn't get said that way, and it should be said that way, but it happens because you've got really gifted social workers overwhelmingly at CIS, in contrast to Boys and Girls Club, which doesn't have as many social workers at all. It's a very different kind of model. So we're really dealing with those kids most traumatized in the system. I think that, Heather, your work has been really key in helping, I think, to, you know, from this is the administrator here, helping to, you know, feel good about, you know, the program oversight that we need to provide, but also that the board, I'd be interested if the board has any other, you know, things that as we think to next year's analysis that we should be building on, because I think we'd like to see more of this.
I'm
Yes, all the data that we actually get directly from the school and the school database. And additionally, TEA pulls their own data without us to match the students that we serve and how they and their school, you know, ID number as well. So all of the data comes from the school. All of the data comes, you know, directly from them. The only thing that comes from us is the student health and wellness assessment. That is our SHAW behavioral assessment. But that one has been approved and validated by TEA.
In reading improvement, for example, does that help you identify which students will be served and how they will be served?
So it's a part of the formula, but it's not the only part of the formula. We really take a holistic view. So every student gets the SHAW assessment, mm-hmm. plus we also have guidance for our staff members. If this student has this and this student has that, plus this SHAW score, this is the targeted need that you should be focusing on. So it's part of the formula. It's not the only thing that we look at. But we do collaborate with teachers, and we're also part of the child study team where the school is studying the children, and the school is really mainly focused on the academic part because we let the school do what they do best, and that's teach. Mm-hmm. We do what we do best, and that is work on the social, emotional, and mental health of the child. So together, we are a great team, but we're part of that. But we don't need that. We expect the school to do that.
But in terms of what you do for the students at their home site, so on the properties, you're providing additional tutoring, et cetera, and mentoring activities. And those are usually being provided by what, college students?
By us, AmeriCorps. We just started bringing AmeriCorps members. So it's college students or our HACA coordinators or our program managers, our AmeriCorps members, but we're also bringing in partners.
And what type of training do they receive prior to working with you?
So everyone has to do a criminal background check, and their information is also then given to the school district to pass the school district's criminal background check. And then additionally, they have to go through a CIS volunteer training. Where we talk about how you interact around children. We talk about our cornerstone to working with students, our behavior management approach, just really safety guidelines.
So in terms of academic training?
That comes from the partner. So, for example, the UT Seek program. Those are college students. They have their own program. They are trained by UT Seek, and then they provide that level of expertise to us.
How long have we had a contract with communities and schools?
This year will be 25 years.
Yes, ma'am. It's been a really remarkable partnership, and we've talked about ways to celebrate that this year in the fall. We're overdue that conversation.
We definitely need to.
Don't get any funding from TEA?
We get funding from the legislature. So we are a line item appropriation through the legislature, and we have to meet their rigorous review through the Legislative Budget Review Board. Every year, TEA collects our data, just like schools, and they submit it to the LBB, and the LBB evaluates it, sees it, and decides if they will approve our contract. We go through a lot of rigorous standards. We also do federal risk assessments through our national office, where we are looking at if we are operating in a safe way as an organization for children. And then we do accreditation every 3 years. And because we also receive government funding, we have to do a audit from the City of Austin, Travis County, City of San Marcos, and One Star.
Okay.
have you encountered any loss of funding from the government?
Yes, ma'am, $1.8 million.
And how do you plan to address that?
By working hard, I'm just saying. By begging. No. So two things. We do have some money in savings, so we're using some of that. But we are launching three things. The first thing that we're launching is a $5 million initiative to bring into CIS within the next 3 years. So we're asking our board and our closest friends to increase their support to CIS. The other thing is that we're starting a giving circle. And then the last thing is I am just about to launch an advocacy plan to see if we can get a line item appropriation with the city of Austin. But you know their budget deficit is huge. I probably should have tried 3 years ago, but I was still learning my job then. And prayer.
Lots of prayer.
And so that's why I couldn't be with you last time, because I was actually in Washington, D.C. advocating for funds for CIS, but I'm happy that I'm able to be here with you all in person today.
We're delighted to have you.
Thank you.
And by the way, I have an apology. I cross-signaled with Leilani, and we thought we didn't say we didn't have this exactly right. So Sharon just sent up literally like 48 hours ago that we were hoping that she's on the agenda to kind of and you moved heaven and earth. Thank you, really. I'm sorry. Well, and on the front end,
seed evaluation for your prompt response and your ability to be here and be prepared.
Did you just evaluate me? Did I just say I did well? Well, you know, my actual evaluation is Friday. I'm going to write this down. Dr. Duncan Hall.
So if we do this 25th anniversary celebration right, you know, our hope would be that maybe we could help raise some money as well for the cause, which would be great. I have one last question. Have you all felt any impacts in who you can serve based on immigration status?
We have. We have felt some of that. We have found that students didn't want to come to school, that parents were asking us to come pick up their students because they thought that they would put the entire family at risk. There are families who chose to not go to work during that time, so then we saw that the needs that they had for basic needs, support, and housing was high. But I'm going to share a quick story, and then we had one student who was in the classroom, and their principal called them out and said, "Hey, just want to talk to you." The parents just hadn't signed something. That child thought that he was going to get deported and urinated on himself in the classroom. And that's an example of this consistent trauma and stress and fear. And I will tell you that that's not an isolated incident. We have students who are having anxiety attacks in the classroom. We have parents who are also experiencing this level of anxiety.
Thanks for coming today. Really appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner, can I suggest a quick, maybe a quick
5-minute break?
And then we'll figure out what the next order is so we can wrap up by, I think we want to try to be done by 3:30 at the latest. So, take a 5-minute break, I'm sure?
5-minute break? We'll allow 6.5 just in case.
Thanks.
Barbara, okay, you're on.
Good afternoon, Commissioners and staff, everybody. I'm going to make it very fast. Okay, even maybe not 5 minutes. So, as you can see, and also including your book package, you'll see the detailed financial report for the as of June 30th, 2025. I put a kind of a summary in very short, just 4 pages, so make it fast. But like as you know that we always have, including the book package, we always include 2 sets of financial reports based on the fiscal year end. Okay, so for the rest and all the other programs. For HACCP programs, excluding the rest and TBIA properties, for the third month in fiscal year 2026, which ends as June 30th, 2025. HACCP had a net income of $2 million This is a little unfavorable to the budget by about $1.3 million. That $1.3 million is due to a slight lower other income from our AG, but most of that because of timing, and a little bit higher of our hub payment. And there was a fire in one of the AHG properties in Ben White. So that's what adds up the $1.3 million. And for the second set of the financial.
What were the cash of these expenses?
Is that about $320,000 in the Ben White, the property, the AHG property.
Okay.
They had a fire on the property.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Okay. And the second set of the financial report is for our pending U.S. CPI property, which had a consolidated net income of a little over $500,000 after the payoff of the principal and the debt service for the first 6 months of the year. And the total, including the $500,000, net income, we use about $420,000 to pay for some capital improvements. Okay. All right, then I'd like to go a little bit more detail, not much, but no, definitely a little bit more detail. As you can see, this is the first set, the fiscal year end of June 30th for all the programs, excluding TDIA red properties. Okay, we are pretty much, we can say we are pretty much in line with what our budget. The only difference that you can see, there's it's just pure accounting treatment. There's a $2.3 million that we transfer from those eight properties that managed by the A&P property. We found they accumulate last year when they closed the book with their surplus cash. So we were able to transfer about $2.3 million from those eight properties. So that's why our revenue has that, including that, but also offset because the property has to record the exact same amount as their management expenses. So pretty much it's a wash. Well, there's no impact on our bottom number. And the other item is higher is in the general expenses item. Like I said, there's about $320,000 the casualty loss to the fire in St. Louis. Okay, the property. Otherwise, we have about a little right above $2 million surplus for the first 3 months for our.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, there's a question about the casualty loss. Because I'm aware there was a fire at one of the Tammy properties.
No, we are in the program set. We are not in the Tammy yet.
Right, okay. Because I think there's some confusion on the Ben White.
Ben White is our AAC prop.
There's no fire.
Oh, that's the staff dollars, but maybe because of the delay of paying the bill. That's what their response. I didn't have to verify. I'm sorry. I did verify with the finance team over there. That's what they told me. I'm going to verify that.
Okay.
Okay. That's what they do show light on the financial report we asked. That's what they told us. I'm going to verify. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I still have a very. I know that there was something not this year. Okay. Let me double check. Let's call this. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the expenses. So insurance, when we receive the money from the insurance, we're quoted as other income to offset. So, but because, like I said, might be a timing, this is when they pay the bill, and we have not received the insurance. When the insurance money comes in, it's going to be a relevant. That's just kind of accounting treatment. So let me double check that one. Okay? Okay. The next one is that I always kind of want to show the major programs. Okay, the operation that is small for those different major programs, not including Tammy red properties. So the AHG, like we talked about, the total day, those eight property management, this is mainly the property managed by the property, A&P property company.
they total have about $2.8 million in revenue, and there is an investment income for AHC, investment, and the interest total about $771,000. And also there's the other income. We reported $3.76 million. Like, as I stated earlier, there's about $2.3 million for the money. The surplus cash we had to transfer from the AMT property to AAC central office, that which is offset by the expenses. And that expense is including the administrative expenses. So overall, for AAC property, program, that's the COC, the joint venture, the A property, the AAC total have a $1.13 million surplus for the 3 months in operation. SHCC is also, as you can see, in the SHCC is very straight, that's from the revenue from top payment and the M&C payment, not revenue from her. Plus a small $11,000 in interest income from the bank account. Total revenue is $164 million, and then they administrate other than the hub expenses. They total have a total operating expenses of about $1.8 million, and their hub payment for SHCC is $158,796,771. There is $152,200 that which will transfer from SHCC to Penny Property to, in order for for the property to meet the debt ratio requirement by the lender rather okay, the investor. So that's from the SHCC. So SHCC after before any transfer to support the COCC and the Penny housing pathway, there is about $3.2 million in surplus. But we use that money to cover the housing pathway and the COCC's operation. The next program department I would like to talk about is the assisted housing, which is our Section 8 program. Overall, they totally receive about $28.6 million from HUD for the top payment and all the M&C and then also the FSS grant. The total revenue for the assisted housing is $29.65 million. The total operating expenses is about $1.9 million. And they also have spent about $27,569,000 in top payments, which is a little bit higher than what we received this year for the 3 months, but because when we closed the book, the assisted housing did carry about $700,000 in surplus in top payment. So that's what HUD always wanted to spend the reserve money first. So that's just a process. So overall, for the assisted housing, for the 3 months, it's about $129,000 surplus. And the next program is our Austin Pathway. Austin Pathway does receive some grant money, including the PDIA FSS grant money and the small local grant and from the local government or the other non-profit organization. So total is about $352,000 in revenue. But the total operating expenses is $852,000 for the operating expenses, that including the staffing, that including all of the support, the CIS, like the Boys and Girls Club. So that, for Austin Pathway for the 3 months is about $500,000 in deficit. Then, like I said earlier, when we close the book, we do it every, like or not. When we close the book, we will transfer the money to make the Austin Pathway as whole. So from the SHCC so far.
When are you going?
During the year, we do it on a semi-annual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it's our one thing to try to
as an educational council, it's not really, we need to physically, just a number, we have to transfer funds here.
Okay. Where do the where do the funds for the operating grants come from?
From Austin Pathway? Okay, the $234,000, that is mainly for the CBI, as I just grant from her. That is from her. We do receive overall nine grants.
Seven grants
from her. For the FSS. Okay. To pay for the staff, no. Employee salary and their benefits. The other small amount, let's say, from the state, and like St. David's, those kind of not. Those, you know, local non-profit organizations. Okay. Any other questions? The next one is the central office. Central office also has a small rental income that's from that we charge it to SHCC and including all the other the interest and all the other revenue, about $818,000 total. The operating expenses for COCC is about $2 to $3 million for the 3 months. So we have a kind of need, financial need, support need from the, it's going to be from SHCC again. We are going to settle the amount every around 6 months, and the final settle at the end of the fiscal year. So the need is about $2.17 million for COCC. Any other questions? No. The very last one is our the other set of financial report from our penny PPI Red properties. All together for those 1,500 units, the manager offered by Hawker staff, by Hawker only. Okay. This study including Charmer or those was managed by the CMA. Okay. So those property for those red property that we total have received the tenant rent. We charge tenant rent $2.8 million. And the other grant that's about the subsidy we received from her, $5.38 million. They also have because the 117,000 interest revenue, but majority of them are from our replacement reserve money. So they are restricted. Okay, but we still have to record it as interest income. They are small other revenues. Just kind of small miscellaneous to receive, like one is like our main screen, the daycare center, those type of no other miscellaneous revenue. So total revenue is $8.48 million for low the red property. The total operating and the operating expense is pretty much in line with our budget for the pool, but except for the one is, I want to mention, you are going to see a little bit bigger gap in the administrative expense, mainly in the salary expenses, and you can see that in the detailed report, that the salary expenses is much, a little bit higher than approved the budget because we did a 3% COLA adjustment as January, but which was not budget for when you approve the budget back in October last year. Okay, so that's pretty much that's the only thing. And also, the total debt service paying for the principal is for all the properties at $508,000. So you can see there's a donation of transfer from the SHCC for the amount of $582,100, which is different from that earlier say it's only $152,000, is because of timing. Because the penny's financial report is for 6 months, from January through June. That in the program, because it's different fiscal year, that's why we need to have a two different set of reports. So it's just a timing. So as you can see, total 6 months, we have to transfer $582,000. To meet the lender's debt service ratio requirements. Okay. So, any questions? And then we do have money in the bank.
Could I
okay.
Can I have a few more?
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I give you two more data points? Did you mention that we are working hard to get increases in the HUD budget? Increases in the budget from HUD. You mentioned that?
No, I didn't say anything.
For our penny rent, for our RAD rent, since we were first adopter, the rents are low, lower than they should be. And so HUD put out a process that you can appeal to get an increase in those rents. Michael Ross and Ann Gass have really been taking the lead, working with Sylvia as well, to try to make sure that we are, first in the queue. There's other first adopters throughout the country we've been working with Chris Lolfo in speaking to Tacoma. Tacoma. And I don't think, David, you guys aren't affected by the RAD stuff. But there's a bunch of agencies that were first adopters of RAD, and were all paid far less than the subsequent cohort of RAD adopters. And so we believe we're going to see something like within we hope by September we'll have some news for it.
We already submitted the one for the BPW, and the last time they told us that we should hear something hopefully this year.
Yeah.
Okay. For
the same thing I'm really glad to tell you is that thanks to Michael and to Britley, who's our admissions director, we're maintaining an occupancy rate of well over 98%, which is really helpful. That's a key part of this. You stay above 98%, then you'll get special claims on the remaining 2%. So.
As we are requesting those increases, is it just us as the PEA administrator? Or has there been a group of early adopters that are requesting this?
A group of early adopters, separate from SACC and that one. Yeah.
Okay. But it was helpful?
Yeah, we feel very encouraged. Yep. And I would tell you that we've been working through Orlando Cabrera and with Len Wilson, and that's been helpful to kind of elevate our argument a little bit. Yeah.
What's been our argument?
That we are, we were an early adopter of RAD because we thought that it made some sense and that it would give us the flexibility to modernize and improve our properties by going and tapping into the market that we thought we could tap into. We're in a great city. There were lots of people interested in working with us. We thought it made a lot of sense and it gave us a lot of additional flexibilities. And that was certainly what then HUD Secretary Sean Donovan portrayed to us. And it did provide that. The problem was that over time, our rents were really constrained in ways that we never thought they would be. They were low from the get-go, and the inflation adjusters never kept up.
Well, and also, Commissioners, when the pandemic hit, the labor supply, the materials, all of those costs just skyrocketed and went way above what we had projected in terms of the income versus revenue, or I'm sorry, the expense versus revenue in the performance. So we were supposed to kind of cross that line by year 15. Instead, it was happening at a much, much
exactly.
Year. So unfortunately, the costs were far outpacing the revenue and the low rent. So we just were not. It was not going to be sustainable. We were in a unique position because we have our subsidiaries that kind of help with these donations, but that's just not sustainable for the long term. And so we made a very, very credible case and argument with HUD that just we needed financial relief. We were well below market fair market rents. I think what under 40% of fair market rent. So we just needed to find a way to get some financial relief, and we made a compelling case. We weren't the only ones. There's probably about 10 to 12 early adopters that are sort of in that queue to be the first ones to get some of the financial relief.
Who else is in the boat with us?
Well, Yakima, as I mentioned. Yakima, Washington.
Cuyahoga.
The
Nashville.
Not Cuyahoga. They had a special case, remember?
Never mind. That's okay.
We'll get the list.
You'll get it, of course. Okay.
NYC, New York, Cosmopolitan, Cleveland.
I think some in South Carolina as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Barbara. Appreciate it. Ron and Suzanne, come on down. So, commissioners, with your indulgence, we're going to turn to a little update on Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's activities, and the conversation is going to be a quick overview because I think Ron and Suzanne want to turn to a conversation about something called Essential Housing Bonds, which is a newer tool that we may be able to use to help develop more affordable housing here in the city. So that's 20 minutes, guys.
Thanks. Oh, I was just going to say I'm excited to spend the next hour and a half with you all as we go through this. So let's.
And you will be sitting that alone.
So, so really, at some point, we would need our own special work session to go through all of AAC in the depth that we would like to share with you with some of the things we're working on. But this is going to be a very high-level view very quickly of 2025 AAC. Is it my microphone?
Oh.
Okay.
Just a real high-level view of 2025 AAC, where we sit with our AMIs across our portfolio, a little bit of update there. I want to share with you a little chart that we're a project we're working on, and I'm going to share one slide with you when we get there, which that will be here. We'll talk about that in a minute. Mike hasn't even seen this, and we're still a work in progress, but I'll explain that to you as we go through it, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Essential Bond Program. So real quickly, AAC 2025, as we sit today, we have in our acquisition portfolio, with the closing of the Kinsey, which happened yesterday, we now own the Kinsey. The Kinsey Apartments, not on the map yet because we hadn't owned it prior to the board meeting, so we just closed it yesterday. We now have a total of 14,570 units of acquisition property in our portfolio. And in our new construction site, we have, to date, 14,570 units.
Compared to where we were last year?
We have added, so far in 2025, 1,499 units, which consists of four closings.
And on the new construction side, we have 9,933 units.
Yes.
And I've only closed on one with 70 units this year.
And so that puts us at a total portfolio of AAC of 24,503 units. And those are both owned by AAC on its own and TACA and or public-private partnerships, which most of those are. But anyway, I thought you would like to see
that.
We're very proud of it, and we hope to get to 25,000 here by the end of the year. So it looks like we're moving that way. Real quickly.
Can you see that in some kind of percentage rate? I mean, that's just astounding.
It's a lot of units.
I can. When we first started this, I was coloring my hair every 5 weeks. Now I have to color it every 2.5 to 3 weeks.
My hole keeps getting bigger, so.
At least you have hair.
Okay. That is very specific. Thank you so much.
I think...
Excellent analogy.
I think one of the most asked questions is are these programs performing to the affordability levels that we would like to see them? And we're quite often questioned what is the right affordability levels, and are we really achieving what we want to achieve by maybe 80% units and 60% units, so how are we doing that across the board? And I constantly say what we've learned, and you're going to see that on this graph, is over time things really work themselves out. And it's a project we're working on. But I wanted to share with you as of today, we have, of those numbers, we were able to verify today as 13,025 files on the acquisition side. And what that means is those are now verified AMI income and income level of our residents. A lot of the projects we just closed on are still incomplete files, and we wait until those tenants come in and renew, or we call them in so we can get updated. They have to supply us with, you know, see if they're in the affordable program or not. So the statistics I'm going to give you now are based on 13,025 units on the acquisition side. Dan's got the benefit of having most of her units at and below. So it's a very deep affordable target. She's got 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s under the tax credit program. And that's almost 10,000 units of consistently dealing with residents that are at 60% and below at MI. And I think when we talk about one specific project that may not sound as deep as it is, this is why I want to give you the whole picture, because it really does balance itself out. But we're really proud to tell you of those 13,000 units, we have 1,832 units, or 18% of our portfolio serving residents at income levels of 30% AMI. We have 1,593 residents, or 15% of the portfolio serving people at 40% AMI. We have 1,749 residents, or 17% of our residents at 50% AMI. We have 1,448 residents, or 15% of our portfolio at 60% AMI. We have 1,688 residents, or 16% of our portfolio at 80% AMI. And only 1,987 of the 13,000 units, or 19%, are greater than 80% AMI. And what that tells you is, got to be careful with the data because we're in a market where it's soft. But these are not just rent levels; these are income levels. So it's not just someone that's paying a 30% AMI renter that qualifies under the income side, but they're paying 80% AMI rent. They're paying their fair rent based on their AMI, and that's why it takes so long to verify, because those rents have to be adjusted to their AMI. We're often being told we're not. You know, we're putting in, yes, you have a 30% qualified renter, but you're charging them market rent. So they're paying 50% of their income goes to rent. And that's not what we do here. So I think it's very important to understand that. What that means is 81% of our acquisition portfolio are serving 80% and below. Mm-hmm. And of that 81%, 65% of that population is at 60% and below AMI.
And that's what I
really wanted to share it, because I know we talked about it a little bit, and not all the properties are going to succeed right away, and this is what happens as we manage our portfolio over time. And I want to jump really quickly in to share this with you, and we're going to move around a little bit because I couldn't get it all on the screen. This is I had my first eyes on this yesterday as well. It's a project we're working on. We have 21 years of data of properties we've owned for 21 years. This is the very first property we bought. It's a Venture Apartment. And what I wanted to share with you is, if you look at the graph, there's four bar graphs. The blue is the average market rent that we could have charged at Venture during its year. So the first able data we were able to pull off of Yardi, we weren't using the system back then, is 2006. So the blue is what we could have charged. The orange is what our average actual rent was in that year period existing on the property. The third chart is what the average of that area, the MSA, the whole area, MSA of Northwest Hills at that time was charging across the portfolio. And usually those are very close matched to what we could have charged on our average rent. And the fourth chart is the average of 80% AMI HUD max rent for residents at 80%. And if you look, you can just basically, if I had a line, and you can look at the blue, which is the market rent, which we could have charged, or even take the, it's supposed to be gray, but I think it looks pink to me. If you look at the fourth bar, you can see that's 80% AMI. But yet our rents are orange. You can see so far below how low below the market rent and below the AMI rents that we have been achieving at Venture over 20 years of operation.
What's the green line in AMI?
The green line is the average of the MSA in the Northwest area. The blue is what we were using as market rent in our own property base at that time.
That's HUD fair market rent?
That's our, just our market rent.
Okay, okay.
Our HUD fair market rent at 80% is the fourth bar graph.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can see our, the market rent was in 2006 was $1,291. Mm-hmm. We were at $619. The fair market value at 80% AMI was $763. And you can look at those numbers. And again, we're going to figure out how to make this more legible for you. And it's brand new, hot off the presses, that I thought this is the very telling that if I take a bar graph and show why as market trends continue to go, you know, heavy shift, we
mm-hmm.
continue to move along this trend line up, the property far below all the debt, almost virtually even throughout 20 years of operation. And I think the most telling thing that I've shown on this graph is it's all the way over to the right. In 2005, our average rent was $1,291 in the market. In 2025, we are charging $1,272. We're actually at $25 below. 20 years later, you can see this. And I think it's very telling when people say, what benefits did we get here? Well, there's 20 years of data that shows we've been able to maintain a stable and affordable base. You can go back to the where you were at the top and maintain that by controlling the rent to how we see how they should be controlled. And so a lot of this is naturally occurring. We don't have to have that much affordability. We don't have to do that, but we do it. And so we have a tremendous amount of affordability up entry. And it's one of our first properties. And I think as we work through the data, and these are not guesses, these are actual numbers pulled right out of Yardi that we've worked with an AI program and a person that we've got every single 48 properties now like this that we're going through. And we're going to put this project together and share with you an overall view of some of the things. But I wanted to go up to the top. You can see that our average tenant duration, which is very telling, over 20 years, we average our tenants staying at a minimum of an average of 4 years at a time. So we don't have a lot of move-outs. That's 4 years, a very long time for a renter. And if you move over, just out of curiosity, I always ask this. Our longest tenant, who is still there today, has been there 33.5 years. At Century, and they're still there.
He was there for the groundbreaking.
That's it. Yeah. And, you know, you can see our move-ins per year, which shows very little turnover. I mean, the first 7 to 8 years, and a lot of these are peaks and then skyrockets. So we went through peaking valleys. And we all remember 2007-8 when we marked the down years and COVID, you know, they so you can see the consistency, pretty very consistent about the turnover that we have in that property. And it tells you a couple of things, because we're doing something right. Tenants are comfortable there and they're happy there and they're not moving out, and our retention rate is really good. So I think if you go back to the chart, I think it's a very high level. We can talk about this for hours. I love this kind of stuff. I actually will Tori and start helping me with a bigger project. Some of these graphs we're going to work on, the change in market rent over years, and I'll share that with you at another time. But I just wanted to show you the big bar graph overall, because I think it's very telling. Data than not. I mean, I can't manipulate that.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be some good ones. There may be some bad ones, too, but it's early. It depends on where we are. And this is what time does with this marriage property. And it's keeping the – and this leads into my next topic, which we're going to talk about our ratings and our essential bonds. But
you know, I wanted to piggyback off of the two presentations we had before. You know, you saw how trauma affects kids. Moving is a trauma. When you continually have to move, these families are averaging 4 years at the property. They're not moving in those 4 years, so those kids have stability. And I think that's our goal for all of our properties, to give these families some stability.
Sure, great. Yeah, I'll try to pull better numbers to that. We need the list.
That's right.
Well, we're going to build a model that's going to show all our portfolios, so we can say, we should do some good things, guys, as much as you think it's not well. So I know you all did receive this multiple times, I think, a copy of the rating, correct? You all have had that copy presented to you. If not, I made extra copies. I thought we gave these to you, but maybe
we did. But why don't we give them a fresh copy?
We're not going to go through this today. I got one for you, Mike.
Oh, no, I got mine.
I know you have
yours. Do you all remember we had S&P come and do a rating of the agency? And basically, it was a 6-month over carefully done review, deep dive into our finances and really every aspect of our operation. And it was a precursor of our ability to be able to get a rating. We got the highest rating in A+.
Yes.
That we're able to get today.
I think what was really interesting about this is
this
is by Standard & Poor's, S&P. And you know, Barbara did yeoman's work on this, and I have to give her 90% of the credit. She worked very hard with S&P as they did their little mini colonoscopy of the housing authority. But I think what was interesting during this process is they first went to us, and they went back, and they looked at our history over years of our operation, and they looked for consistencies, they looked for variances, they looked for one time, you may have all this income, but it came all in one big tranche. And so it's really not an indication of what your company looks like in terms of revenue generation. And after they got comfortable with what we did previously, then they went and they sat us all down. And Barbara remembers this. We had interviews. And they said, what is your goals in the future? What are you doing in the future? And fortunately, we have a strategic plan that you all adopted. And they looked at that very carefully. And they said, well, just because you're here today, what are you going to look like tomorrow? And when they go and present our case to their board at S&P, they have to present the case of a track record, but also a future record of, are we going to continue along these revenue lines? Are these revenues a one-time shot, or are they things that are consistent and are going to be there in years and years? And I'll explain to you why that's so important to them. And then also, what is our long-term goal? What is our long-term plan? And how are we going to continue to grow? How are we going to continue to create revenue streams? And then they go back and they look at our debt and look at how comfortable our unrestricted and our assets, cash, and other assets are compared to what our debt is. And they give us a rating based on that. And that's what we came out with. It was a very long process. It took us a good 6 months. And again, Barbara did actually yeoman's work working with them confidentially. But it's a very interesting report. Some of it probably doesn't make some of this a little bit, needs to be translated in yeoman's terms. But it was a fun process and a good process, and it gave us a good sense of good things. So,
Are the ratings still, because it's been a while since I looked at bond ratings, is it still AAA? 3 and 2, I see we got an A+. Would you tell us what the ratings are?
Yeah, I think it's an A+, then it's a AA+, and then it's a AAA+. And we received the highest for a first year for a nonprofit that they could give you, which was an A+. I really feel like if they didn't have those criteria in place, we probably would have done much better. And if you go back in and look at, how much our assets can cover in terms of how much debt we have, and it's called a debt coverage ratio type calculation, and we're so strong, and it breaks it out in here. It talks about how fiscally, our liquidity extremely strong, our debt profile extremely strong, it really talks about management and governance very strong, market dependency very strong, which is true. It depends on the market. But anyway, it talks regulatory framework, very strong. So they really rated us on so many different categories. And we hope to do this every year and keep improving on that, or at least keep where we're at for sure, which I think we will.
future looks really good. But so what are we going to do with this? You know, first, you know, when we thought about this, we were like, well, you know, this would give us a little bit of an overview of what we're doing here as an agency. But we did not go into AAC property by property. You know, this is not what they do. They look at the housing authority. They look at the housing authority's responsibilities for debt and the income the housing authority receives from everywhere else. And how stable is that income coming in the future? So they're focusing on HACA, not on AAC. So they didn't go in and look at, you know, peel the onions of 93, how many properties we have now? 92 properties total in our portfolio, with more of a focus on HACA. Which leads us to, in a short period of time, this a program as part of our strategic plan. We're constantly looking for better ways to do what we do in terms of acquisition and development to achieve the affordable, you know, growth we want to have. There's a program called the Essential Housing Bond Program. And what it does is it gives us debt control. It gives us the ability to do things on our own without bringing in an investor, without having to pay for private capital, without having to worry about returns to an investor or you know, their bottom line. And they all, you know, private capital costs money. This program gives us the ability to go back in now and do deals on our own if we choose to. That gives us the decision making of where we want to set our rents, how we want to set our rents, how we want to do things without having interference and without having any, you know, pullback or pushback. You know, well, you know, we've got this fund and it's got to reach this type of return. And while, yes, we're affordable and we're going to do as hard as we can, but, you know, we're not, I don't know, I think we're low enough. And this Essential Housing Bond Program gives us that opportunity. Doesn't come without some concerns, and that's why I know Mike would speak to this. We've been very cautious. Suzanne and I and Barbara knows a little bit about this, and we've walked, we've taken various baby steps toward this. Fort Worth has done multiple of these already. They just closed their second one a couple weeks ago. They're in April. And El Paso has done a million of these things. They just run. But really quickly, what it does is if a property costs, let's just use a round number, $50 million, in the typical way we do it, we go and get an equity partner who puts in 35% of the equity down, and we get a note back for 65%, and I come to you and say it's a Fannie note, and it's 5% interest, and 35 years, da da da. This doesn't do that. What this does is it allows you to leverage up and pay 100% of the purchase price through a bond program, in a sense, a bond program. So if the property is worth $50 million, you can essentially go out to the market, and we've been working with KeyBank, and they go out and present, they prepare the bond issue, and then they go out to the market and they sell the bond.
Just for a moment, I know most people know, but this is a refresher. Explain a bond.
So a bond is an instrument that is basically, it's basically a note, piece of paper, and it says this bond is $50 million. It is a $50 million bond issuance. And then that issuer that represents us goes out to the secondary market and walks around everybody and goes, who's interested, who's interested, who's interested? It's paying 4.55%. Well, how safe is it? How do we know we're going to get our money back? Well, we've got this rating, and so the investor's going to go, well, let me look at what HACA has. And so they're going to come in, not to us, they're going to look through our issuer, and they're going to look at the comfort level, the rating, the liquidity, and they're going to put that all in a package together, and they're going to sell it to your local doctor, your dentist, to funds, to anything, anybody else, anybody can buy this bond. And they're given a guarantee, not a guarantee, I should say a pledge, that based on the strength of HACA, we will be able to pay that bond back. So the difference is, if current portfolio, if something went bad, it's a non-recourse debt. Basically, that means the property goes back and we walk away, it's a real, it's called a single purpose entity. There's no liability. It doesn't extend to AAC. It doesn't extend to HACA. And the guarantees, if there are any, are always with the investor partner. In this case, we are telling the community out there with this piece of paper that we're going to sell to you that HACA has the ability to pay this bond back if something ever happens bad. And if something does actually happen bad, HACA has to step up to the plate and make the death payment. That's the difference in risk. It caused us a long time to pause that because we never want to put ourselves in a very risky position. But as you think about, you know, our portfolio today, if we had a property that was upside down, HACA wouldn't let it go back. We would come in and step in and make it whole. We would figure it out. We have the ability to do that. This instrument also gives us the ability to pay down that debt quickly. It gives us the ability to use 100% of the cash flow if we have to and continue to pay that debt down. We don't have to pay ourselves back like an investor wants a 12% return or a 15% return or an 8% return. You know, we can make ourselves maybe in the first 2-3 years 3% returns and put that money aside and pay that principal down. Also, the value of these properties are going to continue to go up, so your equity in that deal is going to increase. So while the 100% of the leverage in these deals is scary, it was scary to me, I'll be honest with you, it caused my hesitancy moving this. As I get more and more comfortable and I talk to more and more people doing it, you know, there's safeguards in place. In this amount of money you fund, they give you some reserves to put away to cover, if, you know, for a year or so if something happens. You can structure this deal so you can insulate yourself in the short run. But in the big picture, you are signing a pledge, not a guarantee, but a pledge that says HACA's assets are so strong based on this rating that they can come to the table and cure any kind of issue we can. But that gives us the freedom and luxury to do anything we want on that property. There's no bondholders aren't going to come and go walk on your property and go look and say, hey, that's rotted wood over there. Hey, we got an inspection today, or hey, we got to do this. They only care about one thing and one thing only. Is this company that we're buying this piece of paper, this bond, they have the ability to pay us back. That's all they care about. So the deal itself, if I bought you a deal and said we're going to use this, they're not even looking at the deal. They're not looking at, they'll say, oh, where is it? What is it? Great. They're looking at HACA, and they're looking at this. They don't care if the property was built in 1972 or 2025. The deal doesn't drive the bond, you know, the rush to buy these bonds. It's the comfort level that we're giving the investors based on who we are. And that's the importance of the rating. Strength of the issue, yes, ma'am.
And we sort of fall into a chance. We're not a municipal bond. This is the private entity.
That's correct.
But we do sort of enjoy this idea of we're a governmental agency. And in this country, thank goodness, there's a view that the full faith and credit of the government is generally behind a bond or a financial instrument, and that it won't be allowed to go into default. And so there's some benefits to that because we're a global government. But it's important that even though this money is cheaper, dramatically cheaper.
And that was the thing I didn't really share with you. It is dramatically cheaper than doing just a normal. What we're doing, because of the credit rating, what we're doing 5.5 to 5.6 now, you know, based on the market. We're talking, what did they quote us the other day, like 430, 4.3. That gives us even more strength in terms of how much we're, you know, less payment means more cash flow, which means more we can place to the debt. And leverage that thing down as quickly as possible.
Right. But just to be really clear, so just like if you went to the bank, if you did it, let's say your $50 million example out, and we decided to get the board approved issuing fit bond for $50 million at, I think you said 4.55%. What's the term of the bond?
On average? Typically, it averages 10 years, but okay. It depends. You know, it could be 10, it could be 20, it could be 30.
So based on our full faith and credit, we're going to issue just $50 million. A third party is going to buy those bonds, and they're going to expect at maturation
that we're giving, that we're going to give them another, what is it, 3 points?
Whatever.
Another 2.5, 2.7 million dollars, whatever that 4.55%, which is, so we're going to owe them that. That's what they're counting.
And the principal.
Yeah, the 50 million plus. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's so.
And there's ways to insulate yourself from risk. Mm-hmm. There's always risk. There's risk in real estate, and we all know that. Every day we do a deal, no matter how we do it.
But that money is dramatically cheaper. Again,
incredibly cheap.
So just like in Hurston Belvoir, where we've done a number of deals, how much is there when we use
the
money?
Well, 100 basis points different from what we closed the Quincy Land versus to what we closed if we did a bond issue or something like that. So you're talking 4.3% versus 5.3 to 5.5.
Yeah.
And that's for the cost of investment. I think it was $40,000 was the initial. Say something like that. And as we're trying to evaluate, I think the biggest question is, what is our capacity under this program? What is it that S&P would say, that's safe, you can do this? And S&P can't tell you that. They're not, their fiduciary is not to us, and they're not an advisor. But they do have in the report, you know, we have about $80 million in corporate debt based on this report. And they say we have enough to cover maybe 3.7 times that, you know, to be comfortable. So if you do 3 times 3.7 of the $80 million, you're talking about maybe $250 million in that we can keep and leverage ourselves up to, which I doubt we will ever do. But we do have that ability, which is very strong, you know, and I'm making that assumption. I can't.
But in Austin, that's really three or four properties.
It's not that much. Two deals that Woodworth did, their first two deals, one was $70 million, the other one was $72 million.
Mm-hmm.
So they're at, they already did them, $140 million on two deals.
And Ron and Suzanne, at the chat meeting, this big new year of affordable housing developers and investors and others, brought together those professionals who work with Fort Worth and others in Texas on doing these transactions to really understand.
There's a group that we visited real quickly, it's the CFP, which is a third party, and they come in and take a look at this as a hands-off, and they would come in as our representative and say, this price is too high, we don't like this, we don't like that. They're the party of no. That's what their job is. Their job is not to tell us anything good about the deal, only everything bad. But that you also have that sense of comfort that we would have a third party evaluating this to make sure we're making the right decisions. And they would go back and argue with the bond issuer, who only gets paid if they place those bonds. So they're going to say every deal is good. So they're the party of yes. We people are the party of no. And so we would bring them into on a deal-by-deal basis. They train us on how they underwrite and how they look at a deal better. I think the first one will be the most difficult if we get there. We've kicked around a couple things. We don't have, I'm not coming here in September with a bond deal for you to look at over there. I think it was good that you see. And it's part of our strategic plan to look at alternative ways to do some of these things. And I've been trying to find better ways. Mainly the positive of this is it allows us to do this. This would not be acceptable in the public-private sector world. They would not let us do this type of affordability portfolio because they would not be making enough. And we do very well. We're very close. I think we owe about less than $3 million on the down venture, and $3 or $4 million. So we're almost, we almost have the debt paid off. So that's what 20 years does. That's what the long-term affordability holds and how we can create. So when people say, you know, year one, you're not giving us any benefit. You're doing the same thing that are already affordable. But over 20 years, you can see how those numbers
the cliffs and how they grow and how we maintain our level. We didn't match. We didn't go up to the average of the planet. We could have had much. We didn't do that. We didn't go up to the market. We didn't purchase everyone. We couldn't have. We continue to adjust. So my point is, that's what this program can help us with. But anyway, more to come on that. I just wanted to brief you.
I think it's important to note that as we look forward, as you all look forward to the next legislative session, housing authorities and some of the work that we do is perhaps going to be more under attack than it was this past session. And it's important to note that these funds are it's a federal program. And so the state legislature, I guess they could always come in and say, you can't do this, but I don't know under what part of the state our code they would do that. But it's additional kind of insurance, I guess, for us so that we can continue to do the work that we do, which is provide affordable housing, if the legislature decides we're not doing it right or that we're not doing enough. So, this is a program that's been out there for a while. I went to a TALFA meeting probably 5 or 6 years ago, and they were talking about these essential purpose or essential function bonds. And I'm like, what are those? So now, obviously, entities are getting very interested because we feel they're threatened.
And so far, they've proven very successful. Again, not without risk, but if you're being careful and you're smart with how you deal with the profits that you make on this, and you set aside that debt and you get that leveraging down to where you, again, the rate is still affordable, which makes it attractive. There's a lot of good things with this program, but again, baby steps, be very cautious, very careful.
To me, this is really compelling information.
When you see Century, and then you see Sterling Village, you see Sweetwater, you're going to see Lexington, you're going to see South Point, you're going to see Tech Ridge and Center Ridge are amazing. That was the most expensive deal we did in 2017. Wait till you see the rent balance. In fact, we're having trouble getting them refinanced this month because our rents are so low that they didn't keep up with the market. We're trying to refinance as our notes do. We're getting through that. But I think there's some really compelling data points. And things that you, as much as you like data, when you see this, there's a lot of things we can extrapolate from this. We're going to look at eviction filings versus how many did we actually kick out. How many affordable housing, we're going to separate affordable qualified tenants from market rent tenants and look at longevity. How long did our market rent tenants stay versus the market, versus our affordable tenants? And did it have an advantage by having those units in there where they stayed longer? We're going to talk about how many families were on the affordable side versus the market side. So we've got lots of things that we're able to pull. The hardest part was putting in 48 properties of data, over so many, 20 years, putting it into a program, writing the script to develop this. And once the script was in, it took about 4 hours to complete 48 properties, through AI.
What's that?
AMP is helping with the data, but we have a separate AI group that focuses on housing that is doing this work on the side. So it's taken a while. And I'm going to roll for him and help me, which I think he can add some good influence into this as well. I've thought about Katie. I brought Katie's name up the other day. So anyway.
Great. So I think it's 50 items we want to hit today. I'd like to point out a couple of things that John is going to say you have to do first.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go through that with that. Let's do that. We're going to have that. Yes, that's okay. Yeah. Do you have a grand total of how much is the student salary? Sorry.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
We're getting there. We did the math to show this time.
We're getting there.
We're getting.
Okay.
And the top part of the thing I think we wanted to share with you, but we'll do it next time, is that in the scholarship program, we're really working to expand opportunity, make sure that through all of our different channels of Boys and Girls Clubs, Teens at School, Boys with the Families, hey guys, Boys with our families and such, that we're getting the message out. All managers, all assistant managers, people are aware of it, because that could be your purpose.
Yeah, and I also would like to get the information, how many are new recipients, how many are continuing students, so we can have that breakdown.
We have that data, so we already have slides today, but we're not going through it. No. We'll add that to the data.
I want to give you quick, under the CEO report, just a couple of quick items. So we are working very, very hard to deal with, we have been concerned that legislation would come dealing with public housing authorities might come into the special sessions that are up. There is another special session. Even though redistricting is done, there's still other issues that are on the call that will keep them in session. But we believe that it's far less likely that Section 392 will be included in the special session happening now. Our folks, Kate Goodrich and Eric Bloomer, actually met this morning with Representative Gates, and the message they have back is that they felt like it was a good, positive conversation, and that there's a starting point that's better than what happened to the State Housing Finance Corporation. The state HFCs, got basically, I don't say they were put out of business, but the restrictiveness of their operating environment is so great that it's really very difficult to see how they're going to be able to do deals quickly or as plentifully as they were doing them before. And the traveling agencies are fully out of this. So we'll keep you posted on that, but that's a big issue. I do want you to heads up that you will probably see in about 2 weeks' time that report from the law school students at UT. So Professor Heather Way, who we met with yesterday, and Dan, I met with her and with all the City of Austin, Travis County, the Teachers Housing Finance Corporation, Travis County Housing Authority. We all sat down with Heather. He's a very, very fine person. The analysis that we heard with respect to fees, evictions, utility fees, and certain other aspects of the property, resident protection, tenant protection. Many of those things are fair, and the report was generated at the request of BASA, a tenant organizing group, to go and talk about those, to go and analyze those issues here in Travis County. The part that I think everyone agreed was not fair in the group was that this report is cast in an umbrella that, receiving the tax exemption, which is the only tool we have, should raise alarm among policymakers because these entities don't do these things. So this report is going to be, it's a tough report. It's not just about us, it's about all those players in Travis County, because it's a Travis County focus report, but it'll be another real attack on the program, or on these programs, that will probably have some media play. I don't think she expected that response yesterday. She heard from, some housing workers there, other leaders were there. I don't think the UC folks expected the response they got. So we have an opportunity that we're working to try to just clarify some points. It's one person's opinion, it's a couple of people's opinion. But I just wanted to know the position of HACA is, the discussion of the fees and some inconsistency with antenna protection. That's fair. We're gonna work on that and improve that. We'll report back to the board. The other stuff, that may be used for fodder by the legislature, and we're gonna make sure we're set up to defend these programs, because I think we think they do a lot of good, and I hope you do too. So just what's the type of anything you want to add with respect to the legislature?
No, I totally agree. I was at that meeting, but in reading the report, which I have done now, and Mike didn't say that it's a hard read, because it doesn't mix with my opinion of the problem, what we've done over 20 years here. But I think some of what Heather stated is very fair. I think, the transparency piece of how we do things, the policy pieces that they can have access to make sure that what we say we're doing, we're actually doing it, it's in writing. I told you this morning, if she's having a hard time finding it, then everyone's having a hard time finding it, and that shouldn't be the case. We're a public entity, even though we do public-private partnerships. I think the good I got out of this is that she brought out some very important and needed transparency disclosures and things that we can improve on as a partnership and as a housing authority on this side of the house to meet her expectations. I don't think she asked for anything unfair when it comes to tenant protections, when it comes to notices of fees. I don't agree with some of her assessment of the fees, but that's I'm not talking about the deep fees. I'm talking about the overall arching issues that she brought up, and I think they were very fair. So I can't argue to that. There are some holes that I don't believe in. I think there's some discrepancies. There's some things that were misreported, could have been misinformation. I don't know how. But I think I'm going to approach this from a positive side and look at how we can, say, all of us together, do a better job at, serving, the people that we serve and making sure that we are doing it the right way. And if that means a policy makeover and sitting down with our management companies and doing all that, I think that's very fair. So I'm not going to say that what she said was absolutely atrocious and horrible, because I think she opened up my eyes to some things that I didn't really think about in depth. We do things so well here as a public entity for RAD and for our public housing, and we have public housing. It's a little different. It's private. We don't do the same thing. But I think those are needed at this time. And so I think that's what we're going to focus on, at least with A&P.
So I just want to highlight also that in just this very short briefing, Ron said, the good I see from this is, and then he also said at the end of it, some of the positives I saw. So we've had several conversations. It's so different from where we were at 10 o'clock this morning. We weren't doing a lot of good. We weren't doing a lot of positive. But we're coming around and we're working through it. There's a lot of it's a 67-page report, and it's a hard read. So we're working through it, and at the right point, we will share it with y'all. Certainly ahead of publication. But we're working through the opportunity that she's given us to make some edits to it or to tweak it and make sure that things are clear. If you all don't mind pulling your pen out, I want to give you some dates. So the next board meeting is set for September 11th, I had a chance to visit with each of you, and so that's a week earlier than we normally would meet, that day worked for Carl as well. So we're going to meet on September 11th, because the following week, several of us will be in Phoenix for the National NARA Conference. So we'll be here at 12 noon, and we'll be here. We may potentially do it in Santa Rita. We may do it at Santa Rita, of course. So stay tuned. But 12 noon on September 11th, location still to be determined. I think the thought was it might be nice to be at Santa Rita. It's going to be our last time to be there before the move happens and such. I also want to give you the date, the Family Self-Sufficiency Luncheon. Hey, Lonnie, is what day? And that's going to be at the... Was it that? I thought it was October. Maybe I'm... And then the last thing I wanted to share with you was that we have the HUD regional administrator coming, as I mentioned, next Wednesday, August 27th. So the schedule for her is that at 9:30 she's going to be at Chalmers Court, and we're going to do a staff overview, welcome her, and give her a staff overview of 5 or 6 key areas. And then at 10:30, starting at 10:30, we're going to get her in a car, and we're going to take her to we'll walk her around the rest of Chalmers Court, but then we're going to take her over to Rosewood Court, and then over to Santa Rita. And then at Santa Rita at noon, she'll have lunch with the imam. I'll send you all a schedule, but just know from 9:30 to 1, with a lunch at noon, the regional administrator will be with us. And if you'd like, then you all would like to join us. I think, Mary, I think you're signed up already. That's great. Yes, yes. But we'd love, if any of you would like to be there, you're very welcome to be there. Sure. Her name is Ashley Quinones. Quinones. And her first name is a different spelling than Ashley. It's Ashlea. And she has started in politics. She worked with Bill Graham many years ago in the Dallas office as a caseworker. She then worked for a congressman named Sam Johnson in his district office, and I think headed up that office. And Sam Johnson was a military hero and a really good member of Congress. Then she went and did some work for a healthcare company, and she's got some background in healthcare. So it's interesting, when she comes here, we're going to make sure to show her the clinic at Chalmers. I think this is an opportunity to serve, and this administration is prioritizing foster youth independence, the intersection with healthcare, self-sufficiency programs more generally. So we're going to home ownership, certainly. She's the regional administrator, so she's responsible for 6 states, which is region 6. The country's divided into 6 GSA regions. And region 6 is Texas, is also the biggest, Arkansas, I think Oklahoma, Louisiana, New Mexico. I feel like there's one other, but maybe that's it. But, and then, earlier we met Tony, so different parts of Florida have different leads in each state. We had David Poehler, who retired, Tony was the head of Arkansas. So they have different field offices scattered throughout the region, but she's the top political appointee in this region. And so all of the political and policy decisions that get made at the regional level will flow through her office. You've met different regional administrators. You met, I don't know if you remember, Candace Valenzuela. This is Candace. This is a new Candace.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's all that, yeah. So she was wonderful to work with, and there's that other great folks. Tammy, Beth Van Dyne, yeah, who's now a Congress member. There's a woman named Beth Van Dyne, and she ran for Congress, and interestingly, she beat Candace. She beat Candace all the way. Beth went to Congress, Candace went to HUD, Beth was a really good regional director. And the thing you want out of a regional director is you want somebody to come to the district, come to your agency, and care and ask questions. And I'm glad she's coming. She prefers to visit. She's been our folks in Fort Worth, Mary Margaret, up in Fort Worth. Gets the benefit of having the regional administrators and all the HUD folks, right there, practically across the street from her. So she's had a couple of visits already, and she's been nice. They've built a nice relationship, so we're looking forward to doing that year, and showing her what we do. So yeah, so please come.
And the FSS ceremony for graduation is October 9th.
Great. We're going to send you over. Yeah. The Thompson Center is on the UC campus, and so we can give you more details. So September 11th, obviously next Wednesday, August 27th, September 11th for the next board meeting, and then October. Yeah. So with that, I would say, Madam Chair, can we move to executive session, and we will not go for long.
Okay.
Okay. So we have to read out the, that's a, and Michael and you guys, I think, will text me where you are. Thank you. So the board can go into executive session pursuant to Texas Government Code 551.071 for consultations with attorney regarding legal advice, pending or contemplated litigation, or settlement offer. B, 551.072 of the Government Code for discussion about the purchase, exchange, lease, or value of real estate of real property. C, 551.074 of the Government Code to discuss the appointment, employment, evaluation, reassignment, duties, discipline, or dismissal of a public officer or employee, or to hear a complaint or charge against an officer or employee. And lastly, it's section 551.087 of the Government Code to discuss certain economic development negotiations. So, do you guys mind if we just sit here? Commissioner, we've come out of executive session at 3:43, and no action is being taken, correct?
Do I have to do that? Okay.
We closed the executive session at 3:45 p.m. No action was taken, and so we will now resume with our regular meeting. Or do I need to read this?
No further items to come before the board, but I'm going to make a motion to adjourn.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Move second. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Opposed. The motion carries, and the meeting is adjourned at 3:46 p.m.